Okay, we'd like to go ahead and get started, please. Good evening. My name is Bill Jones. I'm with the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission. I'd like to welcome everyone here tonight for the NRC's assessment of the Diablo Canyon Power Plant operations for this previous year. A couple administrative items on the table sitting just outside the room was a sign-in sheet. In addition, we had handouts that included the end-of-cycle letter, as well as the slides we'll be using for tonight. You'll also find feedback forms outside, and we would appreciate following the meeting if you would provide us any feedback that you would like to help us to improve the conduct of these meetings. We are interested in what you have to say, and we do use that information to improve this type of communications with the public.
I would just add that the feedback forms can also be used to ask questions that either you don't want to ask tonight or come to you later, and we'll make every effort to get back to you either in person or however means that you choose. So they can be used for that purpose as well.
Thank you, Art. Tonight's meeting is being taped by AGP Video. That will be shown on the local San Luis Obispo government channel. We do expect this meeting tonight to last approximately 3 hours. The slides and handouts from tonight's meeting will be available on the NRC website in approximately 10 days. You can go through our Adams program to get to that, but I just want to make sure that people are aware of the address. It's www.nrc.gov, and as I indicated, that'll be available in approximately 10 days. Tonight's meeting is a Category 1 meeting where the audience is invited to observe the business portion. We will then open this meeting up for comments and questions from the public prior to actually adjourning the meeting. We expect the business portion to last approximately an hour and a half, and then we'll take a short break when we will then go into the question and comments period, and Mr. Gaddy will be providing assistance during that period. Tonight, the NRC will describe the federal government's independent inspection process used to assess all nuclear power plants in the United States. You'll also hear how the NRC independently assessed that Diablo Canyon was operated safely during this past year and how we went about performing that assessment. To briefly go through the agenda, we will provide introductions of both the Nuclear Regulatory Commission members as well as the Pacific Gas and Electric. I'll provide a brief overview of the reactor oversight process. In addition, there are handouts out at the entrance table that describe the oversight process in more detail if you would like to see that. I'll provide a summary of both the national and specific plant performance this year. And then Pacific Gas and Electric will be having comments relative to the discussion points from today. We will then break for approximately 5 minutes and then open the meeting for questions and comments from the public. The NRC representatives here tonight are to my right, Mr. Art Howe. He is the Division Director for the Division of Reactor Projects in Region 4. Myself, Bill Jones, I'm the Branch Chief with responsibility for Diablo Canyon and two other facilities for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. To my immediate left is Mr. David Prue. He is the Senior Resident Inspector at Diablo Canyon. Mr. Prue is a member of this community. He is the one with the responsibility for overseeing the day-to-day inspection activities at Diablo Canyon, his responsibility for responding to any events and conditions, and has overall the day-to-day NRC presence. In addition, to his left is Mr. Tim McConnell. Mr. McConnell is the resident inspector at Diablo Canyon. He shares the similar responsibilities for the day-to-day assessment and inspection of the facility, and he also is a member of the local community. Not here with us tonight is Mr. Terry Jackson. Mr. Jackson will be taking over as the senior resident inspector in the near future. Mr. Jackson is not here tonight. He is in continued education training associated with his position here at Diablo Canyon. Also to my right is Mr. Vincent Gaddy. He is a senior project engineer in the Region 4 office. We also have Mr. Victor Drix in the back. He is our public affairs officer. Out at the table was Ms. Agnes Chan. She is our administrative assistant. And also is Mr. Jared Nadell here. He is on rotation to the resident inspector's office. He is out of our Region 4 office. With that, I'd like to provide for Pacific Gas and Electric introductions.
First time, Greg Rigger, Senior Vice President, Generation, and Chief Nuclear Officer for Pacific Gas and Electric. To my left is Dave Oatley, who's Vice President and General Manager of Diablo Canyon. Then Jim Becker, Vice President of Diablo Canyon Operations, and our System Director, our Station Director. Then Chuck Belmont, Director of Nuclear Quality Analysis and Licensing. And last at the table here is Donna Jacobs, Vice President of Nuclear Services.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, the NRC's inspections for Diablo Canyon are conducted through the NRC's Region 4 office. This slide provides just a general overview of the Region 4 office organization that has responsibility for direct inspection activities. You will see that Mr. Art Howe has overall responsibilities for reactor projects. Under him are the resident inspectors. As I indicated earlier, the resident inspectors are the ones who have the day-to-day responsibility for inspection activities at each of the nuclear facilities under the oversight of Region 4. In addition, we have Mr. Dwight Chamberlain. Mr. Dwight Chamberlain is out of the regional office, and he oversees the inspections performed by the regional inspectors out of Arlington, Texas. These individuals include inspection specialties in emergency preparedness, security, engineering, and radiation protection. They provide additional inspections for the baseline inspection activities that are performed at Diablo Canyon, similar to what is performed at each of the power plants in the United States. Also, I'd like to just identify at this time that we do have the public affairs officer here, and as part of this handout at the very end, we do have a number to contact Mr. Drix if you have any questions. I'd like to go ahead and just give that number at this time for anyone who's interested. It's 800-952-9677. And please feel free to contact Mr. Drix with any concerns or questions you may have, myself, or the resident inspector's office. We want to make sure that that line of communication remains open.
Actually, we would encourage you to contact any of us, either by email or by phone, and we'll make sure we give you our business cards if you haven't got those already. Some are out on the table, but any method. And if we can't answer your questions tonight, we'll get back to you or we'll get in touch with the person who can.
Okay. The NRC's mission for the federal government is to license and regulate the nation's civilian use of byproduct material, source, and special nuclear materials to ensure the protection of public health and safety, and to promote the safety, and to promote the common and security and to protect the environment. These goals were established as a foundation to this mission. I'd like to call out two of these goals specifically. First is safety. Safety is the activity we're involved in day-to-day, the daily inspection activities at Diablo Canyon, as well as the support we receive from the regional office in the inspection activities. We also have a headquarters office that's involved in the licensing activities at the Diablo Canyon, and they are directly involved in safety. The other goal that I'd like to point out is openness. One of our principal goals is to ensure that we communicate regularly and openly with each of our stakeholders. The purpose of tonight's meeting is to provide one of those goals of meeting the openness in that we want to, allow members of the public to observe how we conduct business with Pacific Gas and Electric, and then to provide the opportunity for individuals to ask questions and comments following the end of the business portion of this meeting, but prior to its conclusion. I'd like to address just briefly how the NRC goes about assessing the safe operation of each of the nuclear power plants in the United States. And specifically, this will address how we went about assessing the operation of Diablo Canyon. We use two sources of information to provide our assessment input. First of all is we do perform independent inspections, as I indicated, by the resident inspectors as well as regional inspectors. The other method is through performance indicators. This is data that we obtain from the licensees, from each of the licensees in the nation, and they address each of the strategic performance areas. This would be initiating event type, mitigating systems. Those systems are required to operate to prevent core damage, and others. We then assess these under a common method of looking at overall safety significance. And from that, we determine what the appropriate regulatory NRC response will be, how we will engage the licensee, and if we're going to perform additional inspections. NRC performs three types of inspections. The baseline inspections, which are performed at each of the facilities. The follow-up to events and conditions are initiated as need be to any reactor trips, for example, any transients that may occur, or any other type of events that require the follow-up. And as I indicated, Mr. Prue and Mr. McConnell are the individuals who would typically provide that immediate follow-up. In addition, we provide supplemental inspections based on the outcomes from the action matrix. In other words, if there were any findings or performance indicators or both that resulted in findings of greater than very low safety significance, then we can implement additional inspections to make sure that we understand what was being done and how that was being corrected. This slide provides some examples of the type of baseline inspections that are performed. I'd like to point out, again, that we have the operator response to events and conditions. We do look at emergency preparedness and worker radiation protection, for example. Another very important one is the corrective action program. We look at that, at the licensee's ability to identify and correct problems on a day-to-day basis. In addition, we perform a very detailed team inspection every 2 years to look at how the licensee goes about addressing problems and go about resolving those problems in the plant. With regard to the performance indicators, this is the second half of how the NRC goes about obtaining information to perform our assessment. We do collect information on each of the strategic performance areas. This is part of our baseline process. This information is provided on a quarterly basis. It is also displayed on the NRC website under nrc.gov. So that information is readily available. And the information is independently verified by the NRC during this previous year. This slide just provides a visual overview of how we go about integrating the significance of inspection findings and as well as performance indicators. As you can see, they're both green, white, yellow, and red for both performance indicators and inspection findings, green being of very low safety significance, or in the case of performance indicators, only baseline inspection. Those findings can be integrated independently or together to determine how the NRC will respond to a licensee's performance. In that overall integration, we get to the action matrix concept, and this is where we integrate the overall performance indicators and findings to determine whether or not we will need to have increased NRC inspection efforts through the supplemental inspections, whether or not there will be additional NRC management review and at what level that will occur. In addition, you're increasing regulatory action. In other words, there can be things such as orders or confirmatory action letters and other inspections performed. I'd like to provide a perspective for where the plants overall fell with regard to the nation and this integration within our action matrix. In the licensee response column, which was, in other words, all the performance indicators were within the baseline inspection, and all inspection findings we had were within very low safety significance. There were 75 plants in that category. Diablo Canyon was in that category. In the regulatory response, there were 21 plants in that category. Degraded cornerstone, an additional three, and escalating up further, the multiple repetitive degraded cornerstone, there were an additional three plants, for a total of 102. The Davis-Bessie plant is currently under the our manual chapter 0305, which involves a heightened oversight by NRC senior managers. Just to give you a feel for the number of inspection findings and where they fell out relative to the safety significance, in addition to performance indicators, you can see out of all the performance indicators that there were six that crossed the threshold into the white, in other words, requiring additional NRC inspection. In the area of total inspection findings, a majority were within the area of very low safety significance, but there were 11 that fell within low to moderate, and then three that fell within the yellow category. That was just intended to provide a general feeling for where plants were falling out and where findings have been coming out for this previous year. With that, I'd like to now turn the presentation over to Mr. David Prue. He will provide the assessment for Diablo Canyon specifically.
Thank you, Bill. I'm David Prue. I'm the Senior Resident Inspector, and I'm the Senior On-Site NRC Presence at Diablo Canyon on a daily basis. The NRC performed over 4,400 hours of inspection in 2004. This inspection was divided up into inspections performed by the Division of Reactor Projects, which is inspections performed daily by the on-site resident staff, Division of Reactor Safety, inspections performed by Region 4 specialists on specific technical items. These inspections constitute the baseline inspection program. The baseline inspection program, which is required at all reactors, was completed at Diablo Canyon. Included in our inspections was problem identification and resolution, which is inspecting the corrective action program to determine if PG&E is finding and fixing its problems, refueling outages on both units, and in addition to baseline inspections, we performed special instructions on upper and lower reactor vessel head inspections, containment sump inspections, and material control and accountability. And that involves that in light of problems identified at three other plants, including Humboldt Bay, we inspected PG&E's inventory and control of the spent fuel pool. From our inspection results and from the performance indicators.
Excuse me, Dave. I just point out at this point, we did perform that inspection at Diablo Canyon in terms of their material control and accountability of spent fuel, and there were no discrepancies at Diablo Canyon.
Thanks, Art. Okay, from our inspection results and from the performance indicators, we concluded that Diablo Canyon operated safely in 2004. This conclusion is based on all of the performance indicators being green and all inspection findings being green. In addition to inspection findings and performance indicators, NRC looks at cross-cutting issues. Cross-cutting issues can show up in many areas of plant operation. Weaknesses in any of the cross-cutting areas can affect overall plant performance. The three cross-cutting areas are human performance or human errors, problem identification and resolution, the ability to identify and fix plant problems, and a safety-conscious work environment, which is the willingness of employees to feel free to raise safety concerns. And there are criteria for a substantive cross-cutting area. You must have multiple green findings or a safety significant issue, similar causal factors or problems with common themes or causes, or that the plant is making slow progress in improvement, or the scope of their programs are too narrow to correct the problems. At Diablo Canyon, the NRC identified two substantive cross-cutting issues: human performance and problem identification and resolution. Human performance has been appropriately addressed, while problem identification and resolution remains an area of focus. The NRC identified a substantive cross-cutting area in human performance in August of 2003 because of a high error rate, especially in maintenance and operations during outages. To address this, the NRC performed inspections focused on plant manipulations, alignments, and management oversight during outages and plant operations. Over this cycle, we've seen improvement in each of these areas. Based on these factors, we've concluded that PG&E's improvement program has been highly effective in reducing the number of human errors. Because of this, human performance will no longer be an area of focus. Problem identification and resolution became a concern because of inadequate extent of condition reviews, long-standing degraded conditions that were not corrected, and inadequate root cause evaluations of problems. An extensive condition problem, for example, involves failure to determine whether a problem on one piece of equipment exists elsewhere. Some degraded conditions have existed so long that employees worked around them instead of fixing them. For example, voiding in the emergency core cooling systems has existed for several years at Diablo Canyon. To address this cross-cutting issue, PG&E implemented a comprehensive improvement program. The NRC performed inspections focused on PG&E's ability to identify problems, determine extent of condition, determine the root causes, correct long-standing issues, and to prevent problems from recurring. We determined through our inspection that PG&E's improvement program has been effective, particularly through improvement in the Corrective Action Review Board. And the Corrective Action Review Board is a group that reviews the quality and thoroughness of corrective actions. But we still have seen examples of inadequate determination of extent of condition and root cause evaluations. In addition, we've seen instances where items were not properly entered into the corrective action system, and the corrective actions were delayed or did not address the causes. And although each of these issues was of very low safety significance, they have a common theme. Therefore, problem identification and resolution will remain an NRC area of focus. We've continued to engage PG&E on the status of the corrective action program through NRC inspections and through two public meetings. But some concerns still remain. There are some findings involving long-standing degraded conditions. For example, containment cooling fans rotated in a reverse direction. This issue existed on several of them for several years prior to being fixed. And we still have concerns with some of PG&E's evaluation of safety issues. And we're looking for long-term consistency and sustaining their improvements. When we see a higher degree of consistency in implementing the corrective action program, and we've seen significant improvement in the areas of focus, such as correcting long-standing degrading conditions, better root cause evaluations, and improved extent of condition reviews, the NRC will consider closing this cross-cutting issue. And we plan to continue to focus attention on this area through the baseline inspection program.
One thing I want to point out is when we look at a substantive cross-cutting issue, we're looking at issues as a whole and how they could affect overall plant operations. I wanted to point out that each of the individual issues that we used in originally coming to our substantive cross-cutting issue in the area of problem identification and resolution, in addition, those that we found additional examples of that we have addressed in our last end-of-cycle letter, particularly in the area of resolving these long-standing conditions, were all of very low safety significance. However, corrective action program is an area that we want to make sure that the licensee is aggressive and is finding each of those problems. They do address thousands of problems every year, and these do represent a smaller sample of those problems that they did address. However, we do focus on those specific examples, And in doing so, we want to make sure that although each of the examples was of very low safety significance, that individually they don't become more significant, or as a whole that it doesn't become more significant.
I've given a lot of data, and I've defined several terms. And so the question you're asking is, what does all this mean? And to sum up, Diablo Canyon was operated safely in 2004. No safety significant findings were noted. And as a result, we'll be performing the normal baseline inspection in 2005. And we will continue to focus on problem identification and resolution.
Okay, at this point, we'd like to turn the discussions over to Pacific Gas and Electric to address the human performance and problem identification resolution.
Thank you. We're setting up our slides, so maybe we'll wait a second and get that going. Do we have it hooked up yet, sir?
Yes.
Okay. You can go to the next slide, too, since we have that. Okay. We'd like to cover a number of items in our opportunity to talk with you here at this meeting. First of all, as you've already mentioned, there were two cross-cutting issues during the course of 2004 that you were monitoring. One of which was human performance that in your end of cycle report, you decided we made enough progress in terms of resolving those issues that you no longer needed to follow it as a special inspection item. We did, however, want to talk a little bit about what we've done since that time, since this is something that we always need to continue focusing on, and let you know some of the things we've done to ensure we continue to sustain the improvements we made and improve more upon them. We also want to spend the majority of our time talking about the problem identification resolution cross-cutting issue, since that is one you've chosen to continue to focus on in the next cycle here. We also believe we've made quite a bit of progress in that area and wanted to share with you some of the things we've put into place and some of the results we've had in that area. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Jim Becker, who will talk about the human performance area.
Okay, thank you, Greg. So as Greg mentioned, I'm going to speak briefly about further actions that we're taking at Diablo Canyon in 2005 to sustain our improved performance in the human performance area. So this slide shows basically an outline of what I will be talking about. I'll be discussing an update on the human performance issue since it was removed as a cross-cutting issue by NRC. I'll be talking about our ongoing focus on an analysis and some interventions we're making to improve our human performance trends. And finally, I'll talk about our belief that institutionalization of our human performance is showing sustained ownership and it is showing results. And I'll briefly discuss some of the results we're seeing so far in 2005. So to look in the past just for a minute, as David Prue mentioned in his presentation, NRC has removed the substantive cross-cutting issue on human performance. And what you see on this slide is a quote from a portion of the end-of-cycle letter where NRC concluded that the improved human performance stems directly from the implementation of your human performance improvement plan. And so what I'm going to talk about here is where we've taken that plan and gone further with it to take it forward into 2005. And that is actually based on this plan that you referred to in this letter was based on some previous problem analyses we had done. Since that time, we've done another root cause analysis, and I'll talk about the actions we're taking as a result of that. So talk about update on our progress since the removal. The first bullet you see on this slide is really the main point of my talk here. We continue to take the lessons learned from the human performance cross-cutting issue very seriously. Our emphasis of human performance, the importance we place on it, has not decreased one iota since the human performance issue was removed as a cross-cutting issue, nor will it drop off at all in the future in terms of the importance we place on it. And that's really the main point of my talk. We have, like I said, when you referred to the removal of the cross-cutting issue, you referred to our improvement plan that we had in place at that time. That was based on an analysis that we had done, and that analysis has been discussed in previous public meetings. In the fourth quarter of 2004, we performed another analysis of our human performance issues. This was a broader analysis that looked more at organizational issues. I feel it was a very well-performed analysis, and I'll be talking about some of the actions that we have taken and are taking in 2005 to further our improvements. We've had some industry reviews of both that analysis and our corrective actions, and those have endorsed the direction that we're taking. I'm going to briefly talk about some of our human performance results that we're getting, and we believe that to sustain those results and to get further along in terms of human performance, we need to improve our line ownership, and you'll see some of the things we're doing to do that. So when I talk about human performance continuing to remain a very important issue to us, in the Diablo Canyon Performance Plan, we include six objectives at this time that are the six key objectives for the station to further improve our performance as a nuclear power plant. One of those six is what you see on this slide. It is to improve line ownership of human performance at the station. The five actions you see on this slide are direct outcomes of the cause analysis that I referred to that we performed in the last quarter of 2004. This was the broader-based cause analysis that looked past the technical issues and looked more at organizational issues and how they affect human performance. So very briefly, what you see on those five items is a brief discussion of the actions we're taking. You'll also see a name associated with each item. Those are senior leaders in our organization who have the responsibility to take those actions and make sure they're effective. That's an example right there of line ownership. So to step through them briefly, we have taken actions to ensure that error prevention tools are used consistently and effectively across the station. We have put out revised guidance in areas such as verification standards, communication standards. We have raised some of those standards to meet the very latest industry guidance and in some cases to exceed the latest industry guidance, and we're conducting training on those standards right now. Our management observation program has been upgraded substantially. We're going to a program that is much more targeted at specific behaviors and standards. Before this, we had more of a general, sort of a one-size-fits-all observation program. This program now has, for instance, a targeted observation form for good procedure adherence practices. So if I want to go out and perform an observation and I want to look at procedure use and adherence, which right now is a focus for us, I have an observation form that lays out what does good look like in the field for good procedure use and adherence, and that's the form I would use. So it is much more targeted. It's also web-based. It allows for better analysis of the results and better communication of the results of our observation program. And we are seeing improved performance in specific departments as a result of raising the number and the quality of our observations. We are well along in effort to improve the quality and the accuracy of our procedures. As you probably know, we've been going down that path for really a couple of years now. The first two phases of that effort are complete, and we're now in a third phase of our effort to improve both the human performance aspects and the quality of our procedures. We have improved our root cause analysis. I talked about in the human performance area itself where we stepped back and did more of an organizational root cause analysis. We're doing that in other areas as well. Donna Jacobs will talk later this evening about efforts in terms of longstanding equipment issues and corrective action program where we've done that. We've provided more training to our cause analysts on how to better look at organizational causes behind our problems, including human performance problems. And finally, we have created a formal human performance program that goes across the station. And the elements I've talked about in this slide are some of the elements of that human performance program. The next two slides, I'm going to talk a little bit about our performance at this time. So we've talked in the past about level one errors and level two errors. And when we do have a human performance error, we categorize it based on its significance. And the most significant ones are the ones that we're calling here level one errors. We have for years now at Diablo Canyon had what we call an event-free day clock. And that's a goal we set for the station in terms of how many days we can go between any error that has a consequence for the station. So we have established that clock. For this year, our goal is to average at least 52 days between any error that has any sort of consequences for us. Right as we speak today, our last level one error was on February 8th, so that was 119 days ago. So in other words, we've now gone 119 days between a clock reset or an error that has any sort of human performance consequences. And our current average, based on that clock, is we're now up to an average of 41 days between any sort of consequences on our human performance, on any human performance errors. So we're making good progress when it comes to the highest level, which is the level one errors. Next slide, please. This slide looks more broadly. This looks at what we call noteworthy errors. Those would include the sorts of errors I was just talking about, but it would also include a lower level where there basically were no consequences, but they still met a certain level of significance. And what you see is from March of 2004 through April of this year, you see our performance on a month-to-month basis, and that what you see is an error rate. The straight line, the black line you see extending through the graph, is a straight line approximation of what the trend has been. So the overall trend is down, and down in this case is good. That shows a lower error rate at the station. And this is as a result of the actions we had taken previously that we discussed in previous public meetings, and also some of the actions that we've taken in 2005, such as the increased use of observations. You will see in the first quarter of the year, you will see in January, February, and March, we started from a low level, and we did see some increases. We took action on those, and in April and also in May, although you don't see May there on that graph, we had better results. So when I talked about intervention as part of what we're doing to stay on top of human performance, I would offer that as an example. So in conclusion, our human performance does continue to improve. As evidence, I would offer the graph we just looked at and the fact that we've now gone 119 days between any sort of consequential events. And our efforts to ensure continuous improvement are ongoing. We have ongoing analysis of human performance issues when the issues come up. We do good, thorough cause analyses. We look at organizational factors more than we ever have before. We are systematically implementing our human performance improvement plan. We have assigned owners, we have due dates, and it extends across the organization. And finally, we will continue to incorporate best industry practices. We have benchmarking planned now to look at other stations that we feel have very good line ownership of human performance. We will be benchmarking those stations, and we will adjust our plans accordingly. So that concludes my presentation.
Okay, just a quick question. Are you seeing that the practices are being moved down to the working level, to the operators, to the craft level? You talk about the oversight given by the managers, but are you seeing that it's starting to take hold and the best practices that you're talking about from your oversight process, is that being moved down and being picked up and implemented by the crew when you go out and make these observations?
Yeah, a couple things there. First thing I would talk about is through the observation program, I would say yes. Every month we put out a report of what did the observations we did last month across the station tell us. And what we have seen through those observations is some positive trends in terms of procedure use and adherence practices, since that has been a focus for us. We are seeing a positive trend through our observations of better procedure use and adherence practices. We are seeing better safety, industrial personnel safety practices in our people. So we are seeing that. We've also uncovered some discrepancies out there in terms of some personnel safety practices as well that, again, we've intervened on, we've taken action on, and we've turned that around. So that would be one thing I would say there. The second is when you talk about line ownership and moving that ownership outward in the station, out into the line organizations, and is that having an effect? I would offer what the operations organization is doing there. Operations has developed crew metrics so that each crew is now graded on a month-to-month basis on how they're performing. And the performance is basically in a quality area. It's around human performance, training performance, those sorts of safety and quality issues. And as a result of that, we are seeing improved crew performance. We are seeing greatly improved use of the observation program on the crews. And I think that's a direct result of putting that program in place and reinforcing it.
I think another example of moving it out in the organization are the supervisors council and maintenance, where I've observed the supervisors maintenance taking discussing amongst themselves what are the specific behaviors we're looking for in our on our crews. What does placekeeping exactly look like? How do we want to do it? What does self-verification look like? How is three-way communication applied in our case? And that's something I think a year and a half ago we wouldn't have seen that level of activity amongst the supervisors on thinking through how do I want to teach my crews what excellence looks like on some of the human performance behaviors.
With respect to the enhancements to the procedures, could you give us a sense for the scope of this effort? What are you looking at? Is it a technical review? Oh, yeah. Is it a human factors review? Do you have a defined scope in certain technical disciplines with a schedule laid on? And can you give us a sense for that?
Sure. Yeah, that's a good question. The scope is, first of all, I'll say the scope is a large scope, and it is an increasingly large scope. And here's what I mean by that. Phase, and I said this has already gone back a couple of years. We talked in previous meetings. Phase one of this effort focused on a fairly small set of procedures. How many? 60 to 100. It was in that ballpark. It was the maintenance procedures that would be used by contractors in our upcoming refueling outage, right? That was phase one. What we did with that phase was we improved the human factors of those procedures. We added verification steps to them to make sure that equipment got put back together correctly. We removed multiple actions from a single step in the procedure because we know that that can be a setup for somebody to make a mistake. So we improved the human factors of those procedures in various ways. That was phase one. Phase two was a larger phase. It continued to focus more on the maintenance side of things, but now we went out to a broader set of procedures and addressed the procedures that had a higher, that were performed more in-house but had high safety significance or a high difficulty factor. At the same time, operations was taking some of their own actions on procedures at that time. Now we're into phase three, and right now most of that activity is in operations. The number of procedures we're talking about here is over 1,000, certainly. And what we're doing is we're reformatting the procedures to meet the latest industry formats for flow and clarity. We're standardizing our use of terms in the procedures so that there's no there'll be no confusion as to what a certain term would mean. It's consistently used from one procedure to another. The procedures align themselves much better now for placekeeping and checking off steps, and that's a consistent method used from one procedure to another. But this is the phase three is the big, and now maintenance in the second half of the year will be going down a similar path. So phase three is an even broader phase. The time frame we're talking about is, I believe it's 3 year, it's a total of a 3 year project.
Thank you. I was touring the plant yesterday, and I did notice your event free clock reset, and I believe the issue resulted in an unplanned down power,
that's
as
correct.
I recall.
Right.
Could you give us a sense for what other types of issues would be in level one and whether or not that definition has changed over time?
Sure. I'll give you some examples, and I'd welcome Chuck to pitch in here as well. We've had two this year, and I'll to start giving you some examples. The two we've had this year, you mentioned one where we did have an error when we were clearing one component on Unit 1's main electrical generator, and it caused the unit to automatically reduce power. So that certainly had a consequence. That was a human error that had a consequence. That was an example of a level one error. We did have, some inadvertent weapons discharges by in our security organization. There were fortunately no consequences in terms of injuries, but when something like that happens, we consider that certainly a near miss, and we reset the clock for things like that. In our last previous refueling outages, we have had cases where test instruments were not hooked up properly, so we had a diesel generator automatically start when it shouldn't have because a test instrument was not hooked up properly. So that was a human performance error, and again, it had a consequence. So that would be an example. And then the last example I would give you is anytime we have a lost time injury at the plant, we have, because we consider safety to be very important, and we really think there's always some sort of human performance issue behind an injury like that, we have, for the past 2 years now, we have reset the clock for any kind of a lost time injury at the station.
So that part of your question was, has the threshold changed or not? And the answer is no. If anything, over the last 4 years, right, we added things like the industrial injuries, the accidental weapons discharge were two examples of that, that were added to the list that weren't previously, so it's become more stringent now.
Right. Good.
Okay. If you have no more questions here, we'll go into problem identification resolution. David, we'll start there.
Thanks, Greg. This is the one cross-cutting issue that remains for us, and we thought it'd be worthwhile to brief you on our actions in 2005. As you clearly stated at the end of 2004, which is why this meeting is being held tonight, we're still in the problem identification and resolution cross-cutting issue, primarily because of inconsistent implementation of our corrective action program. You stated we've made significant changes, but sustainability of improvements was the key. So what we want to do tonight is talk about the additional actions we've taken to address those issues. So what have we done? You'll hear tonight that we've completed process changes to improve our corrective action program. We now have multiple tools in which to assess degraded conditions and come at it and triangulate on it and make sure we have the appropriate cause. We've completed training on the corrective action program implementation to well over 1,000 people, and we've developed new metrics and an oversight board to review those metrics to drive performance going forward to ensure sustainability. And finally, we'll talk a little bit about use of our new tools on longstanding equipment issues and what we're doing in those as an example. Next slide. So why do we believe we're sustainable in our improvements? Well, what you're here tonight is that we've instituted a formal governance change and metrics to oversee our program and drive line ownership. We've implemented a program to ensure accountability in the organization, and we're starting to see desired results, and we're closely monitoring those and rewarding when we see them going in the right direction and having discussions when we're seeing them go in a different direction. So with this, I'd like to turn it over to Chuck Belmont, and Chuck's going to discuss some of the programmatic aspects we've changed and how the governance is going to work. Chuck?
Must be on. Thank you. One thing we made a lot of changes in 2004 to our program and our processes, and so we took the opportunity in the first part of this year to do an extensive amount of training. So we have about 1,400 people at the site, and 1,000 of those people are pretty much regular users of the corrective action program. And we trained over 1,000 people on what I'll call corrective action program 101, just basic training to make sure they're understanding the new programs and processes we had in place. We did a lot of our training for our formal cause analysis process in 2004. But as we continued to go down the path of apparent cause evaluations, we felt it was necessary to do some additional training there. And we trained over 230 people on the program changes and the process and the techniques around apparent cause evaluations. Another thing we wanted to do, and it goes along with this performance improvement theme for 2005, is we had to establish better metrics around some of our programs and some of the things that we wanted to see, where we wanted to see improvements. So right off the bat, we established metrics around quality and timeliness for apparent cause evaluations. And then one thing that Donna's going to talk about as an example is we're now using, and it's the fourth time we've used it, a root cause team approach to solving more significant cross-organizational problems such as long-standing equipment issues. And this has worked so well for us that we've implemented this and made it a part of our program. We've institutionalized it. Next slide. Got it up there. So line ownership and accountability, Dave touched on that just a little bit, through performance improvement governance. This is something where we make program changes, we have a lot of issues come into our program, so we need a method so that we can monitor and analyze and take actions. And we establish this performance improvement governance process. Part of that process is having good metrics. So we've always had metrics around this program, but we established some improved metrics, which are continue to be a work in progress, including, like I've said before, apparent cause evaluations and root cause analysis quality. And the reason we do that is so that senior leadership and leadership at the plant can stay in tune with anywhere where we're having performance deficiencies, and we can take action in real time. Again, we've established a continuous improvement structure where Jim talked about in human performance. It's really the same with the corrective action program, and that is recognizing good performance and taking the necessary steps when someone or some process is not meeting predetermined goals or standards.
Chuck, you're talking several times about line ownership and accountability. How is that different than before? Line ownership versus who? And can you?
Yes. Yes. Historically, what we've done and what the industry has done is they've had centralized groups that perform a lot of the analysis, look at a lot of the problems, develop the metrics, report out on how we're doing. And it was really more of an organization that was owned, or a process that was owned within my organization. And what we mean by line ownership is where the line folks, operations and maintenance and engineering, security, RP, all the different organizations actually have more involvement. They actually help us come up with the program elements, develop the metrics, and then implement the program. And so what we mean by better line ownership is now there's a process for accountability around that ownership. So you have the metrics, you've agreed on them, you've engaged the line organizations, and now we all know what we're being held accountable to. And it's the line organizations that are now responding. Well, when we first got on the cross-cutting issue, I was doing a lot of the responding. Well, today what you'll see is the line directors and managers are really responding to any shortfalls, and they're talking about the actions they're going to take to make it better versus me typically talking for them.
The corrective action program is a tool, and what we want is our managers and in the line organizations, operations, maintenance, and engineering in particular, to understand that it's a tool for them to use to improve the performance of their organization. And improve the performance of the plant. It's not a tool that Chuck's organization uses to improve the performance of their organization. So that's the fundamental shift in thinking, that the corrective action program is a tool for the line managers to use. It's not a tool that Chuck's organization uses.
Thank you.
And I'm going to talk a little bit more about it in the next couple of slides. Do you have a question?
I can wait, but I do have an interest in what the metrics are and how do you know that that the quality and the nature of the work really has improved through this improved ownership. So you can give us a sense for that.
And I'm going to use a couple slides to talk about the process itself. And then we put three examples of metrics that we have in here and how we use them to improve performance and drive to achieve the results we want to attain. So this really is informally called the wheel. So what we do is we monitor the metrics. So we have a problem prevention and resolution report, a set of metrics. We have some web tools to make it as easy as possible for people in the line to monitor their performance. And then we have defined goals. So we monitor. And then what we do is we analyze and we determine what actions we need to take if we don't meet these predefined goals and standards and meet the expectations that we and get the results we want out of the program. And then the it says around the slide, and this is exactly the way it should work, is manager implements improvements. Then the line organization, depending on their specific performance, will come up with actions and will use the corrective action program to make the improvements we need to make, and will continue to go around. And that's why one of the things we talk about is the metrics are a work in progress. We'll continue to look out in the industry to try to find the best metrics that we can, and we'll keep raising our standard, just like in human performance. We'll continue to monitor, we'll continue to analyze, we'll continue to take actions, and we'll just continue to improve the program, the processes, and our performance. And it's more than just a concept. So the next slide talks a little bit about the structure about around accountability, how we do that. So first, the vice presidents are responsible for program oversight. Leadership starts at the top. The vice president and general manager, Dave Oltley, chairs what we call our performance improvement oversight meeting. And that's where we review our performance improvement plans, we review our metrics, we determine what high-level actions we need to take to improve line ownership, corrective action, get the results that we want. The directors share that responsibility for program oversight. So they also review the performance improvement goals, the metrics, the improvement plans, and they do that monthly with their managers. And you can kind of see how it comes down. Then the managers are really responsible for program ownership. So they help us set the goals and the metrics. They determine the action plans they need to take. And then they work with their folks to make sure that the plans and the improvements are implemented. So that's just a little bit of a synopsis of how the structure works. So what are we going to do moving forward? We're going to continue to work on this. Next steps for continuous improvement. We're going to continue to identify and refine our metrics. We've already completed our formal plan and structure for performance improvement. So that's already in place, and we've already had our first set of meetings in May. And I can't say it enough times, this is the key to how we'll ensure that we'll have a consistent, sustainable performance improvement. This is how we're going to do it. And by the way, this isn't just for performance, for problem identification and resolution. It's also, this part of this performance improvement process is for human performance. It's also done in the same setting because they're very interrelated. We're going to continue to identify metrics and thresholds, like I said, based on best industry practices. So I'll see if I answer the question with an example. There's a lot of metrics, so next slide. So I pulled three out, a couple that kind of shows, you know, a positive, and one that shows kind of where we need to take some action, just to give you a sampling. So this first one here is what we call our level one condition reports, our non-conformance reports. It's our formal cause analysis. And on the left axis is the Corrective Action Review Board score. Each one of these analyses is scored by all the Corrective Action Review Board members, and they're given a grade, and this is those grades, and you can see that there's an increasing trend here where the quality of our formal cause analysis is improving. So we're keeping an eye on this, and I will say that we still do send them back and ask for improvement. So we see this as an ongoing improvement process. That's just one metric. Another example is where typically in our history, we haven't done as good a job as we're doing today in keeping some of our low-level, what we call quality issues or problem reports and issues up to date and keeping our eye on them. So this is just a graph of how many of these types of condition reports we have overdue. And as you can see from this trend line, we've never had zero until recently. We instituted this performance improvement process and held, you know, people accountable to meet this goal. And for the first time in our history, we have zero overdue. And that you're not going to see the swing in the future. It's going to stay at zero. So just in case you're wondering, just keeping things from being overdue, we also have other metrics that make sure that they don't get too old, that we're not just manipulating due dates, that type of thing. So this is just for example. And the third one I put in here is where we talked about these formal cause analysis, and we've been working really hard the last year and a half to improve the quality. And we made a conscious decision while trying to improve the quality of our formal cause analysis and solving problems that the timeliness, we would allow that to take a little longer to go up above our goal. Now, we believe we've corrected our issue with the quality of our formal cause analysis. Now we've taken some steps to bring down the how long it takes us to complete these root cause analysis. So you can see it leveling off, and a couple months after this, it continues to level, and now we're taking, we've monitored it, and we've got some specific actions we're going to take, and we're going to drive this down to the goal of what we see out of there as the best in the industry. One of the things I mentioned, so that's examples of metrics. If you got a question now.
I got a couple questions.
Okay.
I can either hold off, but can you give me a sense for whether or not you have metrics that monitors or tracks program usage? In other words, AR, NCR initiation rates, what departments are initiating, how many people at the station are actually using the process? Do you tabulate that, and do you know whether or not you have pockets where there may be outliers or the usage rate is not what you otherwise expect based on historical trends?
We do a couple things. The first couple things you mentioned is do we monitor the number? We absolutely monitor the number, how many initiated, what those trends are. In addition to that, because that also starts moving into the area of a safety-conscious work environment, people's willingness to bring up issues. Our employee concerns program supervisor periodically goes in and looks at it by organization, looks at the trends, and follows up and goes out and informally talks to people and uses some of the same questions that the NRC uses in the PI and the problem identification resolution inspection procedure, the questionnaire in the back of that where it asks about safety conscious work environment questions. He does that, both of them do that informally, the two people with employee concerns. So the combination of those two gives us a sense that that really has not been an issue. The identification, the ability of our folks to identify problems and their willingness to do that hasn't been an issue. But we don't want to just check that box. We want to make sure we have some metrics that'll jump up in case that it becomes an issue.
So if I were to cut that data, you're telling me I wouldn't find any outlier departments in terms of usage, initiation. I'm just curious because typically we do find them at most plants. There's usually one organization or another that where for whatever reasons, they may be isolated, there may be management changes or the turnover in the staff, and they're not as familiar with the process as you would like them to be.
Right.
And so we typically do see that, and I'm just curious whether or not
Absolutely. We haven't seen anything as a result of management changes, but what we have seen is that some organizations are better at it. Our operations organization is outstanding at identifying issues. Of course, they're out in the plant touching the equipment all the time. I think that's typical, but we want to make sure it's maintained at a very high, healthy rate. However, there's other organizations where the maturity of the use of the corrective action program isn't as far along. Examples might be security. That's an organization where, with all the changes in security in the last few years, that we've pushed the security organization to be much bigger users of not only the corrective action program, but also the human performance program. And they've gotten very good results because of that use. So if you had a look at them, you would see less usage in some of those organizations, but we're bringing them on and we're monitoring their performance and pushing them to continue to use that. There's a couple other organizations that are probably at that same maturity level.
Thank you.
For the Corrective Action Review Board, I made a lot of mention about the root cause analysis coming out of the Corrective Action Review Board. Is there a part of your metrics that is going to take into account the effective implementation of the root cause?
Yeah, there's several things that we do. And some of them through the Corrective Action Review Board and some of them through performance improvement governance. So first, for every formal root cause evaluation, we do an effectiveness evaluation. And we do those anywhere from 6 months to a year down the road after the corrective actions have taken place. For corrective actions that are going to take place, say, in a subsequent refueling outage or somewhere further down the road, we do interim effectiveness evaluations. Those effectiveness evaluations are very standardized and proceduralized, and it says, did you do what you said you're going to do? Did it get the desired results? Did it create any new problems, for example? It's got several attributes where it checks to make sure the corrective actions were effective. Some of the other things we use to monitor that is the Corrective Action Review Board, in addition to the Performance Improvement Governance team process, whatever you want to call it, periodically looks at different metrics. We look for trends. We use our trend program also to make sure that we're getting what we want, getting the desired result. So there's several checks and balances and quite a bit of defense in depth to make sure that we're getting what we set out to get. I'd say the number one improvement that we made recently is the performance improvement governance. And that's also going to feed into when Donna talks a little bit about the longstanding equipment issues, the example there, the corrective action program and the health committee that we're going to create to look at equipment performance are going to be very closely tied. Another check and balance. Am I answering your question?
Yes, thank you.
So again, just some examples of metrics. Sam, we're continuing to, I'm gonna head out here in another few weeks. Myself and a team of folks, we're gonna go out and do some more benchmarking. One of the things we're gonna look at is more metrics, better metrics than the ones we have, and we're gonna continue to grow these. They're absolutely a work in progress, and then they probably always will be. But with that said, one of the improvements that we talked about was this team approach to root cause analysis. We've done this four times. We've actually done it on our human performance program. It was very effective. And so Donna is going to talk about an example, our most recent example, where we use this approach to solve our longstanding equipment issues. So with that, I'll turn it over to Donna.
Thanks, Chuck. So with the example being longstanding equipment issues, you cited three of those specifically in the report, and I'll tell you right up front, we acknowledge and accept the need to fix this. I will cover briefly the three specific examples that were cited in the report, but really, what I really want to focus on is a bigger picture of that, where we entered into our corrective action process, a look to say, what do we need to do differently so we don't continue to have these types of problems going forward. So I want to cover what we've done from a corrective action process, root cause evaluation, corrective actions we put in place, and then what we see is that process to go forward to make sure that we're tackling those issues when they come up. The first issue that was cited in the report, and you mentioned it earlier, was emergency core cooling system voids. And when we look at that, we have managed that in the past. We've done a root cause evaluation on that, and we've identified what we need to do differently to fix that issue. We don't want to live with that issue going forward. We look at the piping configuration and what we need to do there. There is a modification change that we have approved. We will be installing that in our next refueling outages for Unit 1. That's this fall. For Unit 2, it's in the spring. We'll put that into place, and what that will do is allow a place for those small gas bubbles that form to go so that they don't get stuck in the suction of those the pumps that we've talked about. So that states that we're really wanting to fix that issue. We don't want to continue to live with it. The next issue that was stated was the containment fan cooling unit. Again, here was an example where we've lived with this. We've done maintenance instead of fix the issue at hand. And what we've done is looked at that and identified, too, that there is a fix we need to put in place so we don't continue to live with this issue. There's an anti-rotation device, a modification that we can make that we will put in place so that we don't live with this going forward. We will fix this issue. Again, it's in our next refueling outages, which will be this fall and next spring, to make sure we take care of that. A third issue that was cited in the report was a containment spray pump cable ground. This is a little bit different. This one really calls into looking at our troubleshooting and the immediacy of which we attacked this issue. And with that, we recognize the need we need to do something different. Now, with the issue that's stated, we have run new conduit and new cable, so that is in place. And that is taking care of this specific issue. But looking at it, we recognize the need we need to do something different. We've implemented a new maintenance policy on how we attack grounds. And the intent of that is to look at how timely are we, what's the importance and the prioritization of going after those. So when we have vital equipment that have grounds, those do need to be addressed much sooner, and we're implementing that. Recent example of that is our auxiliary salt water pump, where we had a ground that came in. We did need to take time up front to identify what potential risks there were with doing the troubleshooting. Once we got past that and went into the troubleshooting phase, we identified what the cause were. It was non-safety related functions of that pump. We were able to lift those, or basically take those out of the circuit, and we do have plans in place. We're going to fix that at the next opportunity when we can take that pump out of service. So those are a few specific examples. And really now what I want to do is I want to stand back and look at it from our corrective action process. And this is really, I think, where we can show it's an example of what we've done from the corrective action process. We needed to look back from a root cause perspective and say, what are the organizational factors that have led us to have these kind of issues, because we don't want these issues going forward. So we formed a root cause team. And I think it's important to point out that we had clear engineering ownership to take this on. Chuck mentioned earlier about line ownership and what does that look like. Well, we had one of our engineering managers who stepped up, who participated and actually led our technical review group. And she was very important in this to make sure that we looked at the broader picture of what we need to do to fix the issue. And to me, that's what line ownership is all about. It's not having to force that from a corrective action group. It's a line organization taking that and going with it. Now, we recognize in order to fix these kind of issues, it is a team effort. It does take operations, maintenance, engineering all working together. But it's clear that engineering has that lead to drive that to make sure we fix these things going forward. We did use a cross-disciplinary team. This is one of the corrections or the adjustments we've made in our corrective action program. So we had a cross-disciplinary team that came together. They were dedicated to do the root cause evaluation. And these are lessons that we've learned in order to be more effective in our corrective action process. When we took a look at this, we wanted to look in the aggregate, in the bigger picture. In the past, sometimes what we've done is we've looked at individual equipment issues, and we haven't stepped back and looked more broadly. And so that's what we did. We identified a sample population that, by looking at those, we could determine what the common cause, the root cause was that we needed to address, and what kind of corrective actions we needed to put into place. We've also learned in our corrective action process the need to use multiple root cause evaluation techniques. It's a way of self-checking our work to make sure we're coming up with the right root causes and the right corrective actions. So we did employ multiple techniques to do that. Something else that we did was we wanted to use outside experience and expertise in this process to make sure that we were getting to the right root cause and also to the right solutions. And in doing that, if we want to back up one slide, please, what we'll see is that we used an industry organizational improvement manager. You know, our focus here was to look at organizational issues that were driving the reason why we had longstanding equipment issues. This person came in, reviewed what the work we'd done with our root cause evaluation and corrective actions, had some tweaks and adjustments for us that we incorporated. We also utilized our Nuclear Safety Oversight Committee. This is a committee that comes together, looks at safety from an outside perspective. We used one of our outside members to review our root cause evaluation and our corrective actions and provided input and used that input as well. And something else we wanted to do was to look at what are the best industry practices when we talk about how you resolve longstanding equipment issues. There's a fleet of plants, Exelon plants, that tend to tackle these kind of issues well. And we brought in one of their operational specialists who knows quite a bit about processes and organizational factors that are used to address these. He came in, he reviewed what we did, he worked with our team, and helped provide some more experience and expertise into that root cause and corrective actions. Okay, so what did we come up with when we looked at all this? We look at the heart of it. What we found is that we did not have a consistent method to identify, prioritize, and authorize these types of equipment issues. They could come up and be approved by different authorizing boards. There was different ways to communicate that information. And so we didn't have consistency on how we screened these, on how we prioritized them, and how we looked at what we needed to do for the fix. So if we look at the corrective actions we're putting into place, what we want to do is really drive one single integrated process that all of this funnels through. And we looked at best industry practices, and what we see is something you may have seen at other power plants, which is called a plant health committee. And it's a single committee, usually chaired by the plant manager, or in our case, station director, to help provide that focus that's needed to look at the equipment issues across the board for the station, look at what the priorities are, what is it that we need to do to fix those. They have standard screening criteria. We'll look at information from our corrective action database. We'll look at our system health reports. We'll look at different things that impact our operators. All of those will be screened, and that will be used for the consistency that we need to make sure that we're following what we need to do to tackle these kinds of equipment issues. So if we look overall at what we're doing here, really it's a great example of where we used our corrective action process to evaluate what we need to do differently so we don't continue to have longstanding equipment issues going forward. So we're developing a plant health committee, putting that into place that'll have set criteria that will be used to review and identify those types of equipment issues. We are looking at what metrics that we can use to trend performance. Recently, I was at an industry meeting where one plant had some metrics that were touted as being very good. We've brought that back, and we're looking at how we can implement those. We're looking at how we put more visibility and more priority on these issues. Obviously, we've got some interim time here before that plant health committee is put in place, so it's really important for us to make sure that we've got the right focus on these before that plant health committee is up and running. And a couple examples. I mentioned the saltwater pump. Another one is a tank leakage that we've had. And we've gone after that. We've identified the location of the tank leakage, which valves are leaking, and we do have those identified to fix. They are in our schedule to be fixed at the next opportunity. So it's really looking at what we can do to focus and fix these issues. So kind of in summary here, what we've done is utilized our corrective action process. We've utilized some of the improvements that we've seen from dedicated root cause evaluation teams, utilizing industry experience and expertise to help us come up with the corrective actions we need to solve these kinds of problems.
If you have some questions, go ahead.
In terms of how you approached your work, you said you looked at a sample. Was that pre-identified? I mean, did the team put together the sample by culling out different lists? And how did you do that?
Right. Good question. So how did we come up with that sample? What the team did, and this was a cross-disciplinary team, they went out and looked at what kind of list do we currently keep at the station? What do we have that might be identified as an operator workaround or burden? What are the things that are out there that are causing us problems? Also, we did some interviews and said, okay, what are the things that get to the gut of the operator, and do we have those kind of things factored in this list? And we came up with different items, basically, that we put up on a board. And then we started to bin them, and we looked at what is a sample that we can look at that's representative of the issues, because from the focus of that root cause evaluation team, it was to really get at the organizational factors that were driving us to have these. So their function wasn't to go in and look at each specific issue, but to say which ones are the ones that really capture the heart of what's happening here to make sure that we can figure out what we need to do differently. So based on their looks, we used 14 of those issues. Some of them were safety significant. We also learned lessons from the industry that sometimes you have to look at those that aren't as high in safety significance as well so that you can balance that and make sure you have corrective actions that hit all of those. And that's how we came up with that sample that we used to do the root cause evaluation.
So based on that, really two follow-up questions. Were there any surprises?
Were there any surprises? When we look at it from the perspective of longstanding equipment issues and recognizing we need to do them different, I don't think that there were surprises. I think it's, though, a different way to look at it that we may not have looked at it that way 6 months ago. But when you start to put on the new lens, the new glasses you look through, you recognize that there's something you have to do different. And so from that perspective, I didn't see surprises in there.
So if I understand it correctly, then these process improvements that you're putting in place as a result of this analysis, you believe will help you look at these things through the right prism in the future going forward.
That's correct.
I understand it.
Exactly.
And then secondly, a related question is, how do you know the list is comprehensive? I mean, all the things you did were certainly reasonable things to figure out what you have on your plate, but how do you know that there's other things, latent issues out there that you somebody hasn't told you about yet that's, you know, pooped away in their desk drawer, you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. It was not our intent when we came up with that list to be all-inclusive. What we were looking at was that sample population that we could really investigate and look at what we needed to do differently from an organization. So when we look at, though, the corrective actions we're putting into place, where we pull information out of the corrective action database, where we pull information from our system health reports and we interview our system engineers, that's where all that data comes together. So by putting into place the plant health process committee, which I've seen work before, you're basically going through that to bring all of the issues in. So while we didn't pull all those out in the root cause evaluation, that was not our intent. It's really to use the process that we have set going forward to do that.
Yeah, and I understand that. I understand it wasn't your intent as part of the analysis, but in terms of trying to ferret out what longstanding issues you have, was this intended to be the feeder for that? I mean, was this intended to be the means by which you identify the total population of these longstanding issues that, at some level need to be corrected?
It's a great start for that, because what we've done now is we've gone back through that list that we started with, and we've looked at all of those and said, where do we stand with all of those? So we've evaluated every one of the items that was initially used as an input to say, where do we stand? Is it completed? Is it in process? Has the corrective actions been put into place? And to kind of give you an idea, when we looked at that, 50% of the items that we screened through are actually complete. Another roughly 35% are actually in progress, so they have corrective actions identified. And so when you boil that down, you're talking about 15% or so. Of that, about 5% are ones that we're really still focusing on determining the right root cause so we can figure out the corrective actions needed. Now, that will be used with the Plant Health Committee. They'll want to review that list as well as even look broader, because they'll want to go out and look at what else may be out there that wasn't pulled into that original sample representation. They'll be looking at all of that.
I think the point we want to make is that the list was put together to find the real cause of the issue, and we want to go up to the real cause. If we were to stop at a list, and you have a comprehensive list at that, we would never have gotten to the true cause of the problem and prevented reoccurrence of additional longstanding equipment issues from occurring down the road. So when Donna describes the process changes we're making and the programmatic aspects, programmatic changes we're making, it's getting to the true cause of the problem, and by funneling the right information through there, will then prevent longstanding equipment issues from occurring.
And I appreciate that, and I agree with that. And I, my interest is just in trying to have a deeper understanding of what's actually going to be done with the issues that were identified. And, of course, we will follow up on that through our baseline inspection.
Yes.
And we already have started that, actually.
What I'm interested in knowing is maintenance's role in this. And, you know, going back 2 or 3 years, I don't really believe that there was a formal troubleshooting procedure and program at the site, and what we've seen over time is slowly that the troubleshooting program is gaining more and more acceptance and use. And it's not 100% yet, but I'm just interested in how you see maintenance's role in resolving the longstanding equipment issues.
Yeah.
Jim Becker will answer that.
I'd say a couple things on the maintenance role. First of all, David, you talked about troubleshooting, and that the troubleshooting procedure that we're using nowadays, that was originally developed primarily by engineering, although they got input from other organizations. Engineering had the lead on that at that time. However, nowadays, the owner of the troubleshooting process is the maintenance organization. So maintenance is tracking. They're in charge of tracking how we're doing on our troubleshooting efforts. Is the process working right? Are there changes we need to make to it? So that's a big part of addressing these kind of issues is good, effective troubleshooting. The second thing is the actual repairs. I mean, when push comes to shove and it comes to completing the repairs and eliminating and crushing these longstanding equipment issues, primarily that's going to be the maintenance organization through, you know, a good planning effort, good work in the field, and not having rework. That's the other big maintenance part of this issue.
If there are any other questions, I'll go to closure.
One more question. Considering we're dealing with age-related equipment issues, granted that it is very easy to see the significant items that are older now, part of your program, does it take into account age-related issues for some of the more, let's just say the less significant circuits? You mentioned the Yawk saltwater pump. You troubleshot it and that it is not part of a safety significant circuit, so you removed it. Does your program capture age-related conditions like that are longstanding?
Definitely, and how we go about doing that is through our system engineers and our system health reports. And so what they look at is looking at issues that are within their system, and then also looking more broadly to say, where are we with obsolescence? Part of the issue there could be, are there sufficient parts available to repair an issue if it's identified? So it's looking a little bit broader, not only at aging equipment, but part availability and if something needs to be done differently with that.
Okay, so in conclusion, so what have we done? In the last year and a half, we've completed numerous process changes to improve our corrective action program. We now have multiple tools available to us that we did not have available a year and a half ago. We've completed plant staff training on our corrective action program. Over 1,000 people have been trained regarding that. We've also established formal governance and metrics to drive our corrective action program and drive line ownership in that regard. And we've used this new corrective action program processes on items such as longstanding equipment issues and the human performance program that was mentioned by Jim Becker previously. So why do we believe we're sustainable in our improvements? Well, we've improved line ownership with corrective action program. We are seeing our line managers take greater ownership. You wouldn't see some of the improvement in results that in the metrics if we hadn't already started to see some of that. We have governance in place to ensure this ownership and accountability going forward, and we're seeing results, and we're closely monitoring metrics to ensure we maintain our momentum going forward. And then regarding longstanding equipment issues, that's an example of a problem prior to our program changes. We've been using our improved corrective action program to determine the cause and corrective actions for longstanding equipment issues, and the improved corrective action program and management monitoring via some governance changes will ensure satisfactory implementation of our corrective actions here. So with that concludes our presentation. Greg, do you have any closing comments?
Yeah, we basically tried to cover the two major issues, one of which you closed in your report, the other which is still open, to give you an update of what we're doing. And the main point is that we're going to continue focusing on both these issues. I think we've made some additional improvements that you've seen here and taken quite a few actions that I think will sustain those improvements going forward. With that, we just open it up to any additional questions you have, but that ends what we wanted to present.
Any additional questions from the staff?
Mr. Ruger, we do appreciate those comments. We will be following up as part of our focused inspection for the substantive cross-cutting area and problem identification in the upcoming inspection, which will be issued around the end of July, 1st of August timeframe, where we will, as part of our problem identification and problem review, is to assess the overall condition of where we see the improvements going, and we'll be addressing this issue again in our mid-cycle review, which will be conducted in August of this year. I do want to thank you for your comments. We want to address how you, members of the audience and others can contact the NRC, if you like, to report an emergency. We have numbers identified for that to report a safety concern, and where you can go to get general information again at nrc.gov. Also, Mr. Victor Drix is always available to take any calls. His number is also on the slide, and he would welcome any calls or questions that you may have. Just some additional reference resources available to us are the reactor oversight process and where you can go to find additional information on how we perform the overall assessment, the public electronic reading room, as well as a document room. And all of the NRC inspection reports, our assessment reports, the performance indicators, and that information is available on the NRC website. And with that, I'd like to conclude the meeting. We'll take about a five-minute break, and then we'll come back and take questions and comments from the audience. Anything else? Okay, we'll take a five-minute break and come back with questions and comments from the audience, and Mr. Gaddy will provide the guidance on how we'll go about doing that.
Now? Now's it on? Oh, there you go. Okay. No, just I'd just like to welcome all of you to the question and answer portion of our meeting. We will entertain questions regarding the Diablo Canyon Power Plant and any other issues that you may have. As facilitator, my responsibility is to assist in making sure that the information that's presented by the NRC is clear and responsive, and also to assure that everyone who wants an opportunity to participate in tonight's meeting has that opportunity. Now I'd like to take a few moments to talk about the meeting process before we get into the substance of tonight's discussion. I'd like to talk about the format of the Q&A session and a very simple set of ground rules. In terms of format, we're going to try and keep the meeting simple to maximize the interaction with everyone. The expectation is that the question and answer period be conducted in a professional, orderly manner. With regard to ground rules, if you have a question, just signal me some way just move to the end of the hall, the end of the aisle, similar to like we did in the last meeting. And I'll bring you the cordless mic and allow you to answer your question, ask your question or make your comment. Please try and keep your questions and your comments to less than 3 minutes. This will support our goal of allowing as many people as possible to participate in the question and answer period. And as time allows, at the end of the discussion, additional questions will be entertained. Although we're not making a transcript of tonight's meeting, the meeting is being videotaped. So I ask that you please state your name and affiliation, if appropriate, prior to asking your question or making your comment. I also ask that only one person speak at a time. This will ensure that we all provide our full attention to whomever has the floor at that time. That will also eliminate any potentially distracting side conversations. And if we don't get to everyone's questions tonight, you can feel free to contact any one of us, as Art said. We'll be around after the meeting, and we also had a contact number. That number was 1-800-952-9677. So with that, let's begin the discussion. Questions?
Right here.
I'll hold the mic.
Oh, you hold the mic. Okay. My name is Jane Swanson. I'm speaking both as an individual and as a spokesperson for the San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. We do thank you for being here. In the early years of our intervention, starting in 1973, we had to jump up and down and beg to get the NRC to come here. So thank you for that. I'll give you a point under openness on your performance goal chart there for coming to San Luis Obispo and for letting us speak. I would like to structure my comments around that performance goal chart, the sixth slide that you showed. I like that a lot. And I'm not going to speak to every single thing on there. That would take all night. But I just picked a few. One of your performance goals is effectiveness. And under that is the word timely. And I know, and I'm speaking to the NRC, not to PG&E in this case, but I know that you want the public perception of your function to be that you are effective and timely. So I have a suggestion for you. You might go back to your colleagues at the NRC and explain to them the problem with the rejection of the petition submitted by the Nuclear Information Resource Services with Mothers for Peace as a sign-on. The petition asked that the NRC order all nuclear plants, including PG&E, to have all sirens with a backup system, preferably not dependent on the grid. And I understand PG&E is working on that in a way that's much more effective and closer to being timely than most nuclear plants, so they can have a point for that. But most of the siren backups are dependent on the grid still. And as you know, we're in earthquake territory. So, I mean, just envisioning, you know, another big earthquake like the one in Paso Robles a few years ago, if it's more in the environment of Diablo Canyon, it will disrupt electrical power, as happened at the end of 2003. And if the power is disrupted and an earthquake can also disrupt other things, including nuclear power plants, then your backup isn't going to do you any good if it's dependent on the grid. So that's why we're strong advocates of solar-powered backup on all of the sirens. I understand you have them on a few. So that would be timely. to talk your colleagues into reconsidering that petition. Another on your performance goal was safety, and
well, I think Bill would like to respond to that.
Do you want to respond to one thing at a time?
Okay. Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'd like NRC also considers the backup power issue to be important. As you indicated, there was a 2206 petition that the NRC did respond to recently. In that petition, there were essentially two requests. One was essentially for generic communications to determine plants that did not have the backup power supply. In addition, there was essentially a request that NRC require the implementation or battery backup power on these signs. We do share and think that that is the appropriate thing to do. The House Appropriations Committee has directed the Department of Homeland Security and the Federal Emergency Management Agency to revise the guidelines to address, in part, the addition of battery power to those sirens, and we think that is appropriate. We have looked at that, and as you indicated, Diablo Canyon is working towards providing battery backup powers to each of their sirens, and I believe the schedule is up for completion in 2006. I believe that there are currently 21 that have been replaced, and I think there's an additional four that do already work off of solar power. But that is a very important point that we work towards that. The NRC was looking at also duplication of effort and recognized, even in a petition, that the Department of Homeland Security through FEMA was working to enhance that guidance. And so those are the activities that have been ongoing. Although we have responded to the 2206 petition, that doesn't negate that we could at some time later determine we needed to provide some additional generic communication to address those sirens. And that always does remain open. So I just want to reiterate to you that the NRC does agree that is an appropriate thing to be done, and in Diablo Canyon specifically, that is ongoing.
Okay, before we get started, so we don't have a long line of people behind this. Could you just remain seated until we recognize you? That way we don't have five or six people lined up behind us here. So. Okay, well, I'm going to get to you as soon as I can. Okay? All right, thank you. Yeah, one other question.
So thank you for that response. And then I go back to the word timely, because I would think the NRC would have the authority and the power to make it happen like now or 3 years ago or 10 years ago. That would be my hope for timeliness, but I'm kind of high standards there. Second point regarding...
excuse me. How many points do you have? Because we're going to try and keep this moving.
One more.
Okay. One more. Okay. And then we can come back to you just so we can get everyone involved.
Fair. I'll address one other of the points that I was thinking about. Regarding safety, and safety is a performance goal, and I'm sure you can appreciate that the viewpoint of a citizen who lives here is different than apparently the viewpoint of those who regulate from Washington, D.C. And regarding the defense against the possibility of a terrorist attack, which the Homeland Security Agency has declared nuclear power plants are potential targets of terrorists, and we all know they sometimes do things from the air, and yet the defenses of the spent fuel pool and other vulnerable points at the Diablo Canyon plant do not seem to be taking this into account. Mothers for Peace even had to go all the way to federal court, meaning as citizens, we're ratepayers, we're taxpayers, and we're fundraisers, because we also have to take these steps that we would wish the NRC would take without citizen action. So we've been, pushing for this to take input from citizens and to do a whole lot more to safeguard nuclear power plants from terrorist attacks, the possibility thereof. I'll stop there.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you for the comment. I do appreciate the comment. And I know one of the things that's difficult for members of the public is that the NRC, in its effort to balance openness and also at the same time not provide information to potential adversaries, we're not in a position, even though we would like to be, to share all the details of all the things that we have done since 9/11, and actually before 9/11 in terms of safeguarding spent fuel pools and also the reactor core. A number of things have been done in this area. I assure you it includes such things as preventing the attack, which extends toward the whole issue of commercial airline security. But it also has to do with some of the immediate short-term measures that were taken right after 9/11 at all the nuclear power plants in the country, which includes such things as enhancing the guard force, including increasing the guard force numbers, standoff distances for ground attacks in terms of vehicle barriers were done, and other mitigative measures to enhance spent fuel pool and reactor core security, which we do believe is safe. Since that time, there's been a number of aircraft vulnerability studies. If you were to look on our website, you will see that some of those are made reference to in our publication that we can get to any of the folks who would like it. It's entitled Protecting the Nation, and it does talk about some of those studies, and a number of actions were taken in response to those studies. And in addition to that, there are still ongoing actions on a plant-specific basis to determine whether or not we can do even more in the near term, and those actions are ongoing. So.
All right, I'd like to make one comment also for the audience. For speaker mentioned that the people at the table here all are from Washington, D.C. What I'd like to let the audience know is that Tim and I here are resident inspectors, which means we have homes here in San Luis Obispo, and our families live, work, and play here just as most of the people here in the audiences have. So we want you to understand that your concerns of the safety of the plant are ours as well.
Okay, we have another question.
Honorable Commission, my name is Joey Ricano. I'm with the Orange County Ocean Outfall Group, and we're a statewide organization, grassroots, that are dedicated to ending all waivers of the Clean Water Act, be they thermal, logging, or sewage. We are currently working within the Morro Bay Estuary watershed because we feel that this is probably the most heavily impacted watershed possibly in the world. The Morro Bay Estuary watershed bite is having big problems, and it's been in the national press, and it's probably going to be staying in the national press. I think right now everybody realizes that if you're a sea otter, a southern sea otter, you don't want to be within 75 kilometers of this place. For reasons that I won't bore you with. Now, what I'm here to talk about tonight is a major concern of environmentalists who are have anything to do with the ocean, and it's also of concern to just the average person. And what that is the issue of single-pass cooling, also known as once-through cooling. Now, right now I'm working with the Morro Bay City Council and the Cayucas CSD as a joint powers agency. And what we're doing is we're implementing a higher level of sewage treatment, and we're making a shorter timeline in which to do it than was originally planned. However, if we were to eliminate the two sewage waivers in California, which are San Diego and Morro Bay, and we stopped pathogens from being dumped in the water, and we stopped sea otters from dying of toxoplasmosis, and we stopped all kinds of stuff, it really would pale in comparison to the destruction that is being wrought on the larva in the Morro Bay estuary watershed and anywhere that there is single pass or once through cooling, mostly on power plants. Now,
excuse me, do you have a specific question?
I would appreciate if you didn't interrupt me, and I am making a point. I am working well within the guidelines here.
Well,
so please allow me to continue, sir.
My question is, do you have a specific question?
I am actually the one with the question. So
okay.
If you do have a question, please let it wait. This is supposed to be done in an orderly fashion.
That's exactly right.
Okay, thank you. May I continue?
Yeah, go ahead.
Just hurry.
Ahead.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. Now, whatever we did to stop sewage, to give it a higher level of treatment, whatever we did to stop sea otters from dying in the area, it all wouldn't really matter if we allowed the continuation of the billions of larvae that are killed by the Diablo intake every day. 2.5 billion gallons of seawater a day are sucked into that intake. Now, there is, and here's the important point, there is better available technology. It's called cooling tower technology. It uses the same water over and over again. You don't want to use seawater for cooling. And the reason why is simple, because seawater differs from freshwater in the fact that it has plankton in it. What is plankton? Plankton is everything in the ocean in its larval stage. Everything in the ocean, except birds and mammals, spends at least part of its life as plankton. Now, while it is a danger that you may have an explosion in one of your waste pools that would kill everybody for 150 miles, that's still just a maybe. And while it's dangerous that a terrorist could come out of the sky with a plane, and we've seen them do it already, or a tsunami, we've seen that already. But one thing's for sure, this single pass cooling and the extirpation of plankton is a reality that is happening day in, day out. And my question is, at what point are we going to come into compliance with Section 316B of the Federal Clean Water Act, which says that you can do no harm in the course of using the ocean unless you're using best available technology and you are not using best available technology? When is this going to come to pass?
I think you're looking at me. And I think the comment was addressed to Diablo Canyon. The studies that we've done at Diablo Canyon over the last 30 years are pretty clear, and we're working with the Regional Water Quality Control Board on use of best technology available. And so far, what the Regional Water Quality Control Board has ruled is we are using best technology. There are some differences of opinion regarding the thermal impacts, which is a separate question, separate issue, and we have a proposed settlement in place for that to resolve those differences of professional opinion. But regarding your question, is currently we're in compliance. Thank you.
Right here is fine.
My name is Joan Carter. I live in this county, and I wanted to present a news release that came out today and see if you had some comments about this. The National Academy of Sciences, the NAS, released a declassified study which finds that pools storing highly radioactive waste at the nation's nuclear power plants are vulnerable to terrorist attack. Congress commissioned the study over a year ago, but its release has been held up since last summer by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which disagrees with the NAS's finding. The coalition issued the following statement today. Quote, "The release of NAS's study puts to rest any doubts about the danger we all face. Nuclear waste at our nation's nuclear power plants is vulnerable to attack. We applaud the Academy for its scientific integrity and its perseverance in seeing to it that these important findings are made public. As with the release of the 9/11 Commission report, today's release of the NAS study demands action. It is not enough to know the danger. We must pass legislation that gets waste out of overcrowded pools. NAS also points out that current dry storage is not without its own vulnerabilities and must be improved. The instability of Yucca Mountain and growing opposition to a proposed dump site in Utah make it clear that nuclear waste will remain at reactor sites for decades to come, if not in perpetuity. Congress must go the next step and require the deployment of more secure on-site storage systems," end of quote.
Did you have a specific question? Or
no, I think I understand the comment, and I appreciate the comment. And yes, we are aware, obviously, of the NAS report that we in the NRC, we've worked closely with the NAS as they develop their work. And actually, we believe that the National Academy of Science report really confirms or reinforces the validity of our own studies that were either conducted before or concurrently with the NAS report. And we do agree that many of the conclusions of the report are same or similar or mirror our conclusions, and there are a number of recommendations. And I'll be honest with you, there are some differences. But nevertheless, the main points, I think, are that both spent fuel storage in wet pools and dry storage, based on the studies that have been done to date, are safe. Now, having said that, it's clear that there is always a possibility that they could be attacked by terrorists, and that's why the actions were taken in this area in the 1970s following the terrorist attack at the Munich Olympics, which resulted in a number of safeguards regulations in the Code of Federal Regulations. And it's also why so many actions were taken, not only by the industry but also the NRC, in addressing vulnerabilities after 9/11. I think it's important to bear or point out that the NAS study did identify and recognize that even though terrorist attacks are possible, it's hard to quantify in terms of probability when they can occur. And they make some recommendations in terms of enhancing safety for both the spent fuel pools and dry storage. And they also make the point that you can't make any general conclusions about some of these studies without plant-specific analysis, and the NRC agrees with that. And as a result of that, every plant in the country is going to get additional assessments to see if there's even more that can be done in the short term to further enhance the safety of the spent fuel pools and dry cask storage. It's ongoing right now.
Sure. Okay, thank you. Yes, and then we're going to try and work that side of the room also, so not everyone can. That's fine. Okay. Okay.
I have a short statement to make. And
excuse me, your name?
Marty Brown. My name is Marty Brown. I lived in San Luis Obispo County and have been a PG&E ratepayer for 35 years. The first time I had the opportunity to speak to you was in 1979. The Diablo Canyon Nuclear Plant had applied for licensing, and there were many concerns about safety. My questions to you that day were regarding not having a viable evacuation plan. I still do not have information, nor does the public at large, about how, where, and for how long we would be evacuated. Is it even possible that everyone in this county could be evacuated? In these days of foreign and domestic terror attacks, this is a problem that needs addressing and solving, if possible, before any new licensing can be given to PG&E. I again had the opportunity to speak to you June 9th of last year. At that meeting, there were many questions regarding security, seismic studies, terrorism, evacuation, and radioactive waste we are stuck with. We get 10% of our electric power from the nuclear plant, but 100% of the high-level radioactive waste with no end in sight. I don't want it in my neighborhood, nor do I want it shipped to someone else's neighborhood. Replacement of the worn-out steam generators, potentially costing $800 million. Who pays? We do, the ratepayers. And they will also be stored here emitting radiation. It's too much on every level. We must convert to clean, renewable energy. There are many options from solar to thermal depolymerization. Other countries are doing this. We can, too. This state's energy policy requires that utilities consider a wide range of options for meeting future energy needs. No matter how you try to persuade us that nuclear generation is safe, clean, and cheap, it doesn't stand up in court. I have a vested interest, as we all do, in the safety of our lives, homes, and businesses. There are three nuclear plants near my loved ones, Diablo Canyon, Hanford in Washington State, and Palo Verde in Phoenix. Who would have imagined that the Twin Towers in New York City would be leveled, the Pentagon attacked, and before that, Oklahoma City? Who would believe a tsunami could kill over 100,000 people and devastate a country? These horrific events happened. We can't take the chance that history won't repeat itself here. Your efforts at safely running the plant are impressive, but there are some things that are out of our hands. But it is in our hands to stop producing radioactive waste, spending millions on packaging it, transporting it, and guarding it forever. It is imperative that all sources of alternative clean energy be researched without prejudice. Until that time that we have substituted clean energy for nuclear, the public cannot be assured of health and safety. My question for you is, could PG&E obtain new licensing if a repository for waste is not found?
Art?
Yeah, the short answer is yes. They can. A number of plants in the country have extended their license.
How much is possible for us to take here? PG&E is going to continue producing, the nuclear plant is going to continue producing nuclear waste. How can you relicense it to keep it going for another 30 years?
There's two multiple parts to your question, okay. If I understand it. I am trying to answer it. There is a defined process for extending the license of the plant. It does involve opportunities for hearing. It does involve opportunities for revisiting the environmental impact statement. So that is all part of the process. And so, and I don't know what PG&E is going to do, but if they decided to go through this process, our colleagues in headquarters who review the license application, the amendment, would come out here for a public meeting and to review the environmental impact associated with that. So any and all issues related to the environment would be considered. They then assess that information and revise the environmental impact statement. They actually update a generic environmental impact statement with plant-specific data and then provide an opportunity for public comment there. So there's two opportunities to raise issues such as this. In other jurisdictions and other parts of the country, local communities have exercised that option. But in terms of the capability to store waste, independent of the national policy issues on the permanent repository, we have concluded that the spent fuel pools are safe and that independent spent fuel storage installation facilities are safe. If they weren't, we wouldn't let the waste continue to be generated.
There's certain things that are out of our hands. Terrorism is one of those things. And a fuel pool, a spent fuel pool, I mean, how do you protect that with guaranteeable protection for us?
There are no guarantees, but what we have studied this issue carefully, and we're people, and we're not infallible, but we have studied this issue carefully, and there have been many changes that have resulted since 9/11 in both of these areas, and there's future changes planned. And I know it doesn't sit well with you, and unfortunately I can't get into the details, but some of the details are summarized on our webpage, and you can see those, and that's not to say that there's not more work to be done. But there is a high level of assurance that the probability of those events are low, and that if they were to occur, that there's even a lower probability that there would be significant harm to nearby members of the public. And so that has been looked at, and it continues to be looked at because there's different ways, and different experts have different views, as you know, on many issues, seismic, whatever it is. And so we're trying to learn from all of that. The National Academy of Science has shared a number of things with us that on first blush that we thought that we had covered, but we're going back and relooking, and so I fully expect that there will be additional actions as well as a result of those efforts. So we are making a good faith effort, but our conclusions to date is that they are safe, and again, there's no 100% guarantee of anything in life, but we do believe they're safe.
Okay, thanks. Next.
I don't know if PG&E wishes to expand on that or not.
No, that's okay.
My name is Henriette Groot. Before I ask my question, I would like to respond, if I may, to Mr. Oakley's comment about the permit.
Okay, go ahead.
I think you gave a rosy picture of the situation. In 2003, PG&E tried to renew its NPDES permit, and the Water Board wouldn't go for it. It was denied. So all PG&E has for the once-through cooling at this point is an extension, an administrative extension of its five-year-old license. And I do believe that even though there are plans to come up with some kind of mitigation, those plans would be more difficult to have go through because of the new phase two regulations from the EPA. That's the comment I wanted to make in response.
Could I address that before we move on? Thank you, Henrietta. I think you're accurate in that we're under a five-year current administrative extension to our NPDES permit. The reason we're under administrative extension is the Regional Water Quality Control Board feels comfortable with our level of compliance and the level of that permit. We are working with the Regional Water Quality Control Board staff to look at the once-through cooling and the new EPA regulations on 316B, the section of EP regulations dealing with entrainment and trapping of organisms and best technology available. And through a technical working group, we're working through that issue, and we'll be they'll be looking at recommendations to us or orders to us down the road. But at the present time, we're in full compliance with our permit. And the Water Board staff is comfortable with that. And that's why we're on administrative extension.
And it's anyone's question how long these permits can be extended indefinitely. Anyway, that's thank you for your reply. I would like to raise a question as a result of a letter that was sent to the NRC care of Mr. Drix. This letter is from the chair of the DCISC, the Diablo Independent Safety Committee, because of my public comment about the inappropriateness. Is it working? Because of the inappropriateness of the name ISPC, Independent Spent Fuel Storage Installation. Now, we like to label things. If you know have a plastic bag that comes from the cleaners, it has a label saying danger, don't put it over your kid's head, things like that. Now why was this name ISPC chosen? Who chose that? Could we have the history of that? I really would like to know who came up with this misleading name.
Would it be possible to get back to you? We do have the letter, and we have referred it to our colleagues in headquarters. We have a spent fuel project office. The term that you're referring to is defined explicitly in the regulations, and I'm sorry, I apologize. I don't know who coined the phrase. It was a number of years ago, and we do promise the chairman of the ISC a response to that letter. And now that we know that you raised it, we'll get with you directly. I do apologize. I just don't know the history. But I acknowledge the point that that words do convey ideas and ideas have consequences, and I fully understand and appreciate the point, and I do I will get back to you.
I look forward to hearing from you. Thank you.
Another question?
Okay. Yes. My name is Ms. Hendred. I'm a retired laboratory technician from Santa Barbara, and I speak as a citizen and as a mother and a future grandmother. You spoke to us at length about inspections that you've made and that you think ensures our safety. I want to ask you about those inspections. What kind of inspections? For example, can you inspect the amount of cannabis or methamphetamine or cocaine in a worker's blood? Can you see, taste, smell, hear, or feel leakage of alpha, beta, gamma rays in or around a nuclear power plant? Can you inspect the bones of a nuclear power plant worker?
Excuse me, that's a lot of questions, and I want to give those guys the opportunity to answer them as they...
Okay.
We can elaborate, but the short answer to all those is yes. There's various means for everyone. For example, the first question involving whether or not somebody's ingesting controlled substances, the licensees by our regulations do have procedures and policies that require random drug testing, and they also have procedures and policies for for-cause testing of individuals who are displaying aberrant behavior. That does happen from time to time at facilities, and they do take action when those cases come up, and it's even a very serious matter when licensed operators are found to be ingesting controlled substances, and I don't know of any examples at Diablo Canyon, but there have been cases nationwide at other plants where there have been problems with licensed operators.
They've been at Diablo too.
Yeah. And so that's the first question. The second question, I'm sorry, could you repeat it?
Can you see, taste, smell, hear, or feel the leakage of alpha, beta, or gamma rays in or around a nuclear power plant.
And I'll ask PG&E to elaborate. We can't see, taste, smell, or feel, but there are multiple methods for sensing radiation.
Well,
I think they're going to respond.
Well, we have several methods offsite. Sorry, we were discussing the comment you made regarding licensed operators at Diablo have had taken substance, and we're not aware of that at all. So I want to make that very clear. And there's very clear regulations that require us to report that. So that was a misstatement. So I just wanted to clear that up. The methods to monitor radiation offsite are numerous. We have installed real-time monitors offsite, which can detect very low levels of radiation, essentially background levels of radiation, which are always occurring. And we would be able to see any change above background. We also have several what's called dosimeters or devices off-site that measure accumulated radiation. Again, they're very sensitive, and we can be able to look at radiation above background, if any. We've never detected anything above background off-site. And we also take samples of the flora and fauna in the area, vegetables, those types of things, and look for any radioisotopes that could come from nuclear power, including in the ocean. And we report that regularly to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission as part of our radiological environmental monitoring program. So there's a semi-annual report that's sent to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and it's part of the public document room.
Well, I do think it's pretty well documented, though, that people around nuclear power plants have a higher rate of cancer, and particularly breast cancer. But I'm sure that you can inspect the brain of a would-be terrorist as they plan to drop bombs on the plants. The inspection, I'm wondering, is it an inspection more of the bank accounts of executives who make their livings on the backs of uninformed workers and neighbors of this diabolical material that threatens to end our life on Earth? You bring us you come here in your fancy clothes and bring us fancy-looking audio productions and fancy-sounding quasi-scientific and economic terms in the hopes that this Orwellian snow job will shut down our common sense and basic reasoning power. The production of nuclear energy is an insane activity. The waste from it is the most lethal substance on Earth. For God's sake, a minuscule amount of it could give cancer to thousands of people, lung cancer. And there's no way to dispose of this nuclear waste. It is deadly for thousands of years. We must stop producing nuclear energy. How dare anyone deprive me or my progeny of our health for generations to come? We must get our energy from renewable, naturally occurring resources, the sun, the wind, heat inside the Earth. We could harness the power of the ocean's waves, and we must conserve the energy we have. We must live more simply. We must act like the intelligent beings that we are, stop the insane production of nuclear energy, shut down this hell's oven, this aptly named Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant.
Any other questions?
My name is Sheila Baker. I just have one question. Why does Diablo Canyon go on high alert when things like 911 happen and not the organic farm at Cal Poly?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question? Because I couldn't quite hear the entire statement.
Glad to. Why does Diablo Canyon go on high alert, or why did it go on high alert during 9/11 or during the various times when the election campaigns were happening, perceived terrorists were around? Diablo was constantly, these high alerts, and Diablo would kind of hover around high alert, or during 9/11 it was on high alert. So why Diablo and not the organic farm at Cal Poly? Thanks.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear about Cal Poly. I can speak to why Diablo Canyon and other parts of the critical infrastructure went on high alert, not only at 9/11, but also at other times. Following 9/11, and actually before 9/11, the NRC had in place a system to alert licensees to issues of potential national emergency that may have an impact on the plant. And all you folks know that on 9/11, you know, the nation was horrified by the strike on the Pentagon and the two towers. And at that particular point in time, the threat was not really well assessed. We didn't know what was next. And so because of these procedures that we had in place, we notified all licensees. And, in fact, my colleagues and I, not only in our regional office, but in our headquarters office and our three other regional offices, went into shift work around the clock for about 3 months in order to assess the threat on the plants. One of the corrective actions that came out of 9/11 was to work with the newly created Office of Homeland Security, which is now the Department of Homeland Security, to better integrate intelligence and law enforcement assessments of threats to not only nuclear power plants but the critical infrastructure. And as a part of that corrective action, and I know folks have seen the color-coded notification scheme, a number of administrative controls and other measures were put into place so that more timely notifications of Diablo Canyon and any other nuclear power plant could take place, so that once threat information was assessed, that it could be passed on to them so that the appropriate increased security measures could be put in place in a short period of time. And so there's been many, you're right, there's been many such occasions that have occurred for various parts of the nation. Many of those occasions are limited in nature because the intelligence information that's provided only suggests that perhaps part of the economy or infrastructure of the nation or particular assets or targets of the nation may be at risk. And so that's why some of these threats, elevation of threat levels and responses to those are targeted for those parts of the nation's infrastructure. But beyond that, I don't know what the issues were at Cal Poly.
The dangerous material at Cal Poly Organic Farm is a bat guana, or the squashes or zucchinis, and so it didn't go on high alert. Okay.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood the question.
Did you want to respond to that, Mr. Oakley?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I first have a comment. I believe that...
Please state your name.
I'm sorry. My name is Molly Johnson. I am a lifelong resident of San Luis Obispo County. I am a mother and a grandmother and a concerned citizen. First a comment and then a question. My comment is that I believe it is immoral to use a technology that gives us electricity today that creates a toxic waste that we leave to the next 800-plus generations to deal with. You mentioned safety. I also have great concerns about the safety of the radioactive waste that's produced. Not only the high level that a lot of people talk about, but also the low level, because low level radioactive waste also contains such radionuclides as plutonium and cesium, which are extremely dangerous, and I think that term low level is extremely misleading. The spent fuel pools and the proposed dry cast storage. Number one, the spent fuel pools. I've been told by PG&E, we've been told by PG&E, that there is no way that a terrorist could possibly put an airplane into that spent fuel pool. Well, let me tell you, my dad was a pilot for 40 years. He flew fire planes for the forestry. Guy knows how to fly. And I asked him one day, I showed him the picture that's on the front of the cover of the proposed dry cast storage booklet that shows PG&E and shows where that dry cast storage sits. I said, Dad, do you think you'd have a problem putting a plane into that? And he said, no way, not a problem. So right there. And I know that that building is not that reinforced. I also had this discussion with him, and he believes that a good-sized plane, and it wouldn't even take an airliner, he said that C-119 that I used to fly would do a really good job of taking that thing down. So my number one question is, when are we going to consider putting truly hardened building around that spent fuel pool?
So let me answer the question. The spent fuel pool is constructed with 6.5 feet of reinforced concrete around the stainless steel liner. studies costing over $1 billion were done by the industry, and I believe the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is doing their own studies, using very, very, very much larger aircraft than the one you described. For the industry, they used a 767 fully fueled at a full landing speed of 350 miles per hour, and it's unable to penetrate the 6.5 foot of concrete in the steel liner of the spent fuel pool. And around that 6.5 feet are additional walls and structures, which they'd have to penetrate a several feet thick before you get in there. And so that's why we feel confident in the impact of a fully fueled plane. Now, having said that, that would make for a very bad day, and it's not something we would like to have happen. The best way to prevent that, obviously, is take protective measures so they don't fall from the sky. But the plant is a very robust design, and you know, if you were able to come out there and see it for yourself, you would see these very large, thick, reinforced concrete walls protecting the spent fuel pool. It's unfortunate the public can't come out there because when if you could, you'd be able to see something. It would make you feel possibly some more comfort.
Yeah, and I would just add that going back to my previous comment that Mr. Oatley did describe the situation at Diablo Canyon, and of course the National Academy did look at this, and we have looked at this, and the industry has looked at this. And going back to my previous point is that they concluded that you need to look at every place further in more detail, and the NRC agrees with that, and that's what we're going to do. So I fully expect that other mitigative measures will come out of this. I can't predict what will come out for Diablo Canyon until that study is completed at Diablo and other plants, but that is in progress.
The other question I had real quick is on the proposed dry cast, or on the proposed dry cast storage. I want to know, A, why the NRC and PG&E basically refused to look at hardened storage for that, and B, is in specific to Diablo Canyon, those high power lines run directly over there. I had a personal conversation with Arjun Makajani, who some of you probably recognize that name. I asked him about that. He said, basically, it wouldn't be a problem unless it were raining, and something came down, and those lines came down on top of those casts, and because of the weather. Have you considered this, and why aren't you even considering using hardened storage, some type of berm or something around those casts?
Okay, thank you very much. The two questions were around the hardened structure and power lines. Addressing power lines first, yes, we have looked at that. We've analyzed several dozen types of potential events on our dry cast storage facility. The fall of our 500 kV towers and lines is one of those. The studies have shown, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission reviewed and concurred, that that would not cause any breach of the container. As far as the hardened structure, the reason we're not installing any further ones is each one of these dry casks are essentially a mini containment. They're 3.5 foot thick concrete, and with steel about 3/4 of an inch on either side of that, so they're extremely robust structure. They too have been analyzed for full impacts of aircraft and other hazards. And being the size and robustness of these casks, any further berm would be unnecessary to protect them. So that's the reason why we're not doing it.
And I would just to amplify on Mr. Oatley's comments, if you were to review our brochure, Protecting the Nation, you will see there is one of the pages in there, and I forget what page number it is, that talks about the studies that were done on the dry cast. There were four different cast designs that were analyzed, representing basically the spectrum that you would see across the industry for those folks who have gone to the independent spent fuel storage installation facilities. And the bottom line is that the conclusion is that there wouldn't be any significant releases that would have harm to the public. Now, in addition to that, there are additional studies ongoing that look at such things as ground assaults, and those are still ongoing. But right now, based on all the studies that have been done to date, that we believe the casts are safe for use.
That Protecting the Nation brochure is available on our website. However, if you'd like for us to send you one directly, if you would just put your name and number down on one of the comment sheets and address it to the NRC, we'll make sure that we get that to you.
I just apologize that we didn't bring some tonight. We have a number of other brochures out there, I'm sure you're aware, and we had a run on those, and so we will get those. But it is available online, but we will get you a hard copy if you ask.
Okay, we have one question here, then we're going to go over there.
I'm Judith Everett, and I live in Santa Barbara, and I come here because I have many questions to the NRC. And I concur with all the previous questions, and I don't feel any safer by your answers. But my questions now are to do with the regular discharge of things like mercury into the ocean. And I don't know, my question is, do you know of the research done in Japan about the Muramata Bay and the fact that mercury was put in there for many years? It went into the fish, and then the humans ate the fish and got very ill. Now, is there any accounting of the fish that are caught at Avila Bay that the people here in this area eat?
Since we live locally, I'll talk about that. I can't answer your question directly about the fish in Avila Bay. I can say that heavy metal analysis, which mercury is one of those, are one of the things we have to sample for. I'm not aware of any mercury in use at Diablo Canyon in an industrial sense. There are some small amounts used in our chemistry labs, probably. But we do have to monitor for heavy metals leaving the plant, and mercury is not a substance we routinely discharge.
I remember in early hearings in 1981, there was a lot of mercury, arsenic, cadmium, and immense amounts of these per billion water, and a tremendous amount of water goes through that plant, we know. So that's something for you to find out, and as one more mark, but the most important thing I want to ask you is, do you know, have you read the book that I spoke about in the first two hearings here called The Enemy Within? I spoke about it twice before, and I left a copy of the book with you. Have you read that? Do you know of it? Have you sought out the information?
I personally have not read the book or seen the book. I'd be interested in knowing more about it. I wasn't at the previous meeting.
Yes. Well, you should know about it because they have proven that within 50 miles of nuclear power plants, there is a considerably more cancer, breast cancer, more AIDS, and more illnesses than up to 100 miles from a plant, and then over 100, there's still less. So they've concluded that living near power plants is a big danger to your health. And people, anecdotally, people have told me around Pismo Beach and the Five Cities, there is more cancer, more miscarriages, more infant deaths than normal. And now this is anecdotal, but I've been up to hearings here where people were absolutely furious with the NRC and the Public Utilities Commission because of these facts. There was a doctor talking. He said he saw so many cases of lung cancer, and he could only put it to the cause of Diablo Canyon. My last part of the question is, after you tell me whether you know of this research, whether you've looked for it, I've got a press release here to let you know how you can get this book and read it before you make any more decisions to allow any power plant in this country to go further, to start up nuclear power or to keep the ones going. In fact, the researchers on this particular question have said the only rational thing to do is to close down all plants, apart from the fact they are sitting atomic bombs. Just one last comment. I was in New York recently to the Non-Proliferation Treaty talks, and they said that only even a conventional weapon could blow a plant. And experts in this, these hearings in San Luis Obispo have said that if the plant explodes, it could destroy half of California. I mean, when are we going to be rational? That's my question, really.
To address the first comments on cancer and the studies that you referenced, that is something if you have available here we'd like to get a copy of, or if you could make that available to us either through Victor Drix or myself personally, I'd like to see that. With regard to your second question, I can just speak to the NRC's overall mission to address the health and safety of the public and to protect the environment. It is an area that, and as you saw through our different performance goals, is of high significance to the NRC, an area that myself, the division director, Mr. Art Howe, my resident inspectors take very seriously in our day-to-day oversight of Diablo Canyon. So I'll say from the NRC perspective, is that we are very concerned with the safe operation of Diablo Canyon, and we do have people out there overseeing that and whatever resources they need to oversee that facility to ensure that it's safe.
If I could just make a couple of comments before proceeding, because a couple of times there's been mention of cancer rates higher around nuclear power plants, and I can say a couple of things. One, I'm not aware of any studies that actually show that, any reputable scientific studies, and there have been a lot of attempts at that. Second, our county health officer is always looking at cancer rates in the San Luis Obispo area. There's nothing relating to Diablo Canyon that makes sense based on the science because we don't detect radiation levels off-site. There are certain areas, communities in the United States that have background radiation 10 times what we see here around San Luis Obispo, Denver being an example, being 1 mile above sea level. And cancer rates in those areas are actually lower than they are in San Luis Obispo. So it's an area where there's still a lot of debate, I understand, and there's still a lot of personal opinion, and I acknowledge that. But if you look at the science around Diablo Canyon, there is no detectable increase in cancer rates due to the operation of Diablo Canyon. So I just wanted to state that for the record.
Okay, we have another question.
Hello, my name is Linda Seeley. Is it on? Okay. And I live in San Luis Obispo. I've lived here for 25 years. First of all, just to make a comment about the cancer question, there haven't been any reliable studies, and Diablo Canyon, nobody can tell us about the actual truth because there has been no long-term scientific study except for John Goffman, who is a physicist, who did do one long-term study which found the only thing that they could prove was that after a nuclear plant closed, the rate of cancer, all types of cancers, went down significantly within several years after a plant closed. But that's the only long-term study that has any validity. I have a question. I have several questions. One is, have you solved, this is for the NRC, have you solved the problem of permanent high-level radioactive waste disposal?
The answer is no. It's a national policy issue. I think most people are familiar with Yucca Mountain. Our role in that matter is to review a license application and make a judgment about whether it would be a suitable depository. They have not submitted that to us yet, so the answer is no.
Okay. So then, okay. So you're going to make you've already approved a dry cask storage at Diablo Canyon, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So how long are these dry casks, how long are they good for? How long do they last?
The dry cask storage is licensed for 20 years.
How long will the rods that are inside of them be radioactive?
That depends, but the rods themselves will remain radioactive for thousands of years. Depends on the level of radiation will continue to decline, the decay heat will continue to decline, but there will be some level of radiation for a long period of time.
Okay. So then what are you planning to do after 20 years with the with the rods if the casks only last for 20 years?
Yes, the cask could be reloaded within 20 years if necessary, or as you indicated, if there's some national policy for some other repository, then that would be available also. But you would look at other available casks to take the place of those casks if necessary.
Or recertify the cask if there's a technical justification for it, too.
So say we do have a repository for the dry casks. How are you going to get them there to the repository?
Yeah, that we're really not in a position to answer that now since that's some way off in the future. But we can, in general, get back to you and provide you the various means. I mean, there are a number of means. In general, spent fuel is transported throughout the nation every year on the order of about 50 shipments per year. And there are a number of provisions in place for selecting the routes, coordinating the routes with state and local governments in terms of security, and a number of other things that are done to protect the shipment. As you know, you live on the coast, so there's possibilities for barge transport of spent fuel, rail, truck, a number of different means. But we're not prepared really to answer the details now, but we would certainly put you in touch with our experts that could provide additional detail for that eventuality if it ever comes to pass.
So then my final question is, why are you, the NRC, why are you promoting new nuclear power plants and license renewals before you have solved the problem? And to me, it doesn't make sense. I don't live my life that way, and I don't think you should make us live our lives that way.
Thank you for the comment, and I appreciate the concern, and I know nuclear energy to many folks is an emotional issue. I reassure you that I am not in the promotion business of nuclear power. I am in the safety inspection business. I am not promoting new nuclear power plants, and I'm not promoting license renewal. It's up to the company to decide whether or not they want to extend the license, and they have to provide the justification. There's a process to do that, but it's not promotion, and it's just not.
Hi, my name, can you hear me? My name is Carrie Filler. I'm a resident of Morro Bay. I may have missed this in the very beginning. It probably starts at PG&E. I missed what it means to accountability of the organization for the formal governance and metric measuring. I'm not sure how you metrically measure human performance.
So I believe what you're asking is, how do we measure human performance? Is that basically your question?
Well, it was stated in one of the slides that there was a formal accountability of the organization, and they had a formal governance and a metric measuring. There was these words, this formal governance, metric measuring, and there was charts of like 0.7, and it went down, and it went up, and it was like for every 10,000 hours. I really wasn't following what all of those terms were meaning. I just had a little clarification. I wasn't sure if I missed it in the beginning.
Sure.
Or this lingo that goes on that I'm not familiar with.
Okay. Well, what I'll do, I'll talk about the way the human performance is measured and that chart that you're referring to, what's behind that, okay? When we have a corrective action program that various speakers have referred to tonight in our talks, and part of that corrective action program is when there is a problem at the plant, and these can be very, very low-level things, boxes not checked on a procedure even though the step was performed. It could be very low-level things. But when those sorts of things occur, we write a report called an action request, right?
that documents that problem occurred. And every day we look at what got reported, what kind of problems did we have. And one of the things we do with that information is we track and we trend how we are performing. So what you saw in that chart was the result of that documentation. So every month we would look at how many problems did we have reported that month, and that outcome of that is what you saw in that chart. And it's expressed in terms of how many problems got reported per how many thousands of man hours got work. So it's a rate, but that's the metric, if you want to call it that. And
so,
and
like,
that's what was on the chart.
On the graph, it said 0.7. So how many mistakes would that translate into?
And Chuck, you can help me out. In a typical month, it could be anywhere from say 4 or 5 to maybe 10 in a typical month.
So it would make up a 0.7.
Pardon me?
There was a lot of 0.7, then it went down to like point something else, and a 0.25. So like a 0.25 would be like one box not checked off during the month.
Yeah, basically something like that.
Kudos.
Yeah.
I'm glad it's working out there. Quality and accuracy is something I'm really happy you guys do. There was another question. Oh, I had some questions about the root cause of problems and accountability and training. And I was just wondering is there a lot of turnover that you have to keep training employees to do this? Or would you categorize your employees as at a maximum, minimum, or how would you categorize your work staff out there?
So how do we characterize our work staff? Well, we have highly professional people. As part of that profession, we do have an extensive training program. Like any professional, whether you're a doctor, you're a nurse, or you're a nuclear power plant professional, you have continuing education credits, you have things you need to do to keep your knowledge refreshed on the standards. And our training programs, while we do a lot for continuing education credits, we did change some procedures here recently. And when you change a procedure, you want to give people a chance to be successful. And so we put people through a training program to be aware of the changes we've made so they can be successful.
My question was, but are you at a maximum staff or a minimum staff allowed? Or maybe it's a question for the NRC.
There is no minimum or maximum staff per se. There is, we've committed as part of our license that we have so many operators, so many chemistry and radiation technicians on staff at any time. We always maintain a staff above that. But if you look at the total staff size at Diablo, we're fairly robust, but there's no necessary maximum minimums for the total plant staff. It's broken down by some specifics like operators and chemistry technicians and things.
I'd like to point out that the NRC doesn't necessarily monitor the staff size, but we do monitor workload. We do monitor overtime. There are some requirements as far as the number of senior reactor operators and operators required to be on shift at a time. We do monitor backlogs for maintenance activities, for engineering activities. And as you heard, we do look at things such as long-term equipment problems that speak to, are they able to address those problems with the staff in hand. And so although we don't specifically monitor staff, we look at those other areas, metrics, for example, backlogs, that give us indications of how that staff is able to address the workload.
One more quick question, if I have, and it has to go with aging equipment. You talked about aging equipment in a different meeting some time back at the Board of Supervisors. There was some call into question of the age of the fire suppression equipment and the engine, and the fire department was there and was actually requesting that PG&E renew or refresh its fire engines and staff. And I don't think, did that happen, or is there a new truck on the way, and what's the status with that?
We do have, as you stated, we do have a fire truck on site that's in state of readiness at all times. There was a comment made that we've had the truck for a while and they would like to see us get a new one. We have will be putting into our general rate case an application for a new fire truck. And it's a couple years out, however, before we get the new fire truck. However, the current one is not that old and is able to fulfill its function on site.
Yes, I'd just like to do a check right now. We have about 15 minutes left on our question and answer period, so we'd like to get through the individuals. If anyone is not able to get through, then, of course, as we indicated early on, we'd be welcome to address any questions or comments directly by contacting the NRC staff here or through Mr. Victor Drix or through the feedback forms.
Okay. All right, we have a question back here, Bill.
Hi, my name is Morgan Rafferty. I'm with the Mothers for Peace. And recently I read on the NRC website that Holtec, the contractor to build the proposed dry cask at Diablo Canyon, has an application before the NRC to build a new kind of cask that would be stored in a bunker underground system. I couldn't find the application online, so I don't know exactly what that would look like. But it sounded like, from the information that I did find, that the Holtec representatives think that that kind of cask storage might be a safer way to store high-level radioactive waste. So I'm wondering if that storage system is something that was considered for Diablo Canyon, especially because of the seismic risk that exists at the site and the terrorism risk.
To address the ISPC at Diablo Canyon, the integrity of the specific casks that were put forth for licensing were considered and were found to be safe for the Diablo Canyon facility and for their specific locations.
I would just say that there are multiple cask vendors, and they have to get a certification from the NRC. And so once they go through that process, then they can be used by licensees who apply either through Part 72 or through Part 50 to have an ISPC. Maybe Diablo Canyon or PG&E can elaborate on why they chose the system they did.
We'd be glad to. We have Gerald Strickland, our project manager for our ISPC, intermittent spent fuel storage. And you'll answer that.
Thank you, Dave. Holtec International has a number of systems that they use. Each is very robust. As with any company, they have a tendency to continue to look at the evolution of their system. And the evolution that you're talking about is what they currently have before the NRC as Amendment 3 to their license. It's a system that is substantially below ground. It's not completely below ground. But one of the issues that they're running into for the licensing of it is the thermal effects, that for dry storage, you need to have the ability to have a passive system that uses convection to be able to move air around the multipurpose canister. And with having a system that's below ground, it's very difficult to be able to discharge heat in that manner. So the NRC is going through the typical licensing process. They're reviewing the application, and that at some point in time, a system such as the one you described may be available. But it's currently not available and wasn't available when we were going through our licensing process.
Gosh, this is weird, because folks know as a former stand-up comedian, we always enjoy holding the mic ourselves. It's sort of like a crutch, you know. But I'll do my best in this new situation, try and make it lively here this late in the evening. My name is David Weissman. I live in Morro Bay. A quick question about the implementation of the National Academy of Sciences report. I know it's been mentioned that it's not generic, it's site-specific. And I know that on the TV news, we have a tape recording of Jeff Lewis of PG&E saying it actually doesn't apply to Diablo Canyon, which I thought was rather interesting, because one of the items which they said did apply to all reactors, pressurized water or boiling water, was their recommendation of a year ago to begin checkerboarding the fuel and spent fuel pools as to disperse it in a way that would give operators more of a time to deal with any impending loss. And I'm wondering why, if that's been around for a year now, nothing's been done to begin to put that in effect, considering that it is a generic issue.
I believe the reason, if Jeff said that, the reason he did is because we've been doing it since we started up the plant. We've always checkerboarded the spent fuel pool and offloaded it. And the reason, for those of you that aren't familiar with it, is if you can disperse the fuel when it's immediately taken out of the reactor vessel, is very hot. And you need to want to disperse that across the entire spent fuel pool and not put it in one location where the heat's in one location. But we've always been doing that.
Then we go on to, well, you had a response from the NRC.
Yes, you're right. That was one of the recommendations, and that is one of the areas that's being reviewed, along with a number of other suggested mitigative strategies that would be reviewed on a plant-specific basis as we go through the process.
That goes back to also the spent fuel pools themselves. I do hear that the liner is a 6-foot thick steel liner, and undoubtedly that is, you know, you'd have to do that Superman walk through it invisible thing to get in there. But my question is, does that apply to the four stories or three stories of superstructure that surround the building as well?
So So the question is around how high does this 6.5-foot thick concrete reinforced go? It goes up above the top of the pool. Above that, if you look at the way it's been constructed, is in essence we've burrowed into the granite in the area, right, and built a pool essentially below ground and surrounded it with 6.5-foot concrete. The top of the fuel is below ground. Above that rises the 6.5-foot thick concrete walls lined with steel, rises up about, I would say, 25 feet or so above the top of the fuel, roughly. And that's carries the water up above the fuel, so you have about 25 feet or so of water above the fuel. Above that, we have a normal metal superstructure, if you will, for environmental control in the area. But the pool itself is surrounded by this concrete. And as you know, as long as there's water in the pool, and you don't have a lot, need a lot of it, but as long as there's water in the pool, it keeps the spent fuel cool and keeps it from any problem occurring with that.
So in other words, then the statements made earlier about the integrity of that, and people spoke about planes, is something coming from above is not protected by 5 or 6 feet of whatever it is that's there. It's just the metal roof that's an environmental control, and not, as is often, I think the audience may mistake that it's like the containment structures above there, but that wouldn't be the case in the spent fuel pool.
You're right on the you're correct in that the roof overhead is has a couple inches of concrete, 2 to 6 inches of concrete, not nearly as thick as a 6.5-foot thick. But again, it's an object coming from above. The only way you create a problem that would affect offsite areas is to be able to puncture a hole and drain the water out. And the water is surrounded by 6.5 feet of concrete lined with steel, and a good portion of it is underground. So the question is, where would the water go?
Well, we'll let that go. We'll get to the fun part now. Is that okay? Would you folks help me out there? Would you help me out here? Okay. Here's how it goes. The real question I have is, we've noticed new sirens going up around the county. At least they look new. They're gray plastic with red trim. They seem wider and all. And I know that, I believe, Jane Swanson from the Mothers for Peace had sent in some requests to the press or to PG&E's PR people, finding out, are these truly the battery-powered backups that were spoken of earlier? And if they are battery-powered, are the batteries also solar-powered as well to prevent a loss in case the actual system grid went down? And if they're not solar powered, why would you not be using a solar powered one? And I have here a nice picture, but I don't have a, you know, overhead to show you on. But it's a solar powered one from the DC Cook reactor on the shores of Lake Michigan, which has the solar panels, much as like one would see on a California Highway Patrol call box. So that would be my question as to why we're not getting, in much sunnier place than Lake Michigan, if you've ever spent 9 out of 12 months in Michigan, you know this, why we're not getting solar powered here as an extra preventative measure.
We worked with the Federal Emergency Management Agency. There's some draft guidelines out that talk about appropriate siren design. You're correct in that we do have some solar powered ones in remote locations, Dave, but as you know, there's only a handful or so. But the remainder of the sirens will have a battery backup, and it's been tested so that they can withstand at least a 24-hour loss of power and still be able to activate the sirens for a full 15 minutes. And that's the standards the Federal Emergency Management Agency draft guidelines suggest. There, when you go look, there's a lot of there's a balancing act you need to do here with respect to maintaining reliability of the sirens, the complexity of the sirens. And the more complex the sirens, the less the reliability could be. We're very fortunate in our siren systems here locally are available 99.7% of the time. What we're dealing with is the other few tenths of a percent we want to improve the reliability on. And during the earthquake, because that was the event that the public started to ask questions about the sirens, we had began the process of considering replacement well before that. Battery backups were going to be part of that replacement. We accelerated it after that earthquake. But remember, the purpose of the siren system is to warn people that something has happened and we should go turn on our radios. The earthquake becomes sort of that warning system too. So it, and so would a large loss of power.
As
so
experienced on the East Coast last year, which was more than 24 hours, that's why the issue came up before the NRC.
And if you look at historically within the PG&E system, we can restore power after earthquakes like Northridge, and, well, Northridge was down south, but up north, when we had the major earthquake in the Bay Area, we were able to restore power essentially in that period of time. So it's reasonable from the standards we'd be able to put our hands on, and reasonable from real world experiences.
All right, well, just so that we have a contribution for those who've taken them here today, we have provided for those who would like it. You like acronyms in the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. This is the San Luis Obispo Self-Contained Reliable Emergency Alert Mechanism. That's the Self-Contained Reliable Emergency Alert Mechanism. And for those here who do experience such an outage, we might give a little... that as well. I will submit to the NRC the picture from the D.C. Cook saying if it's good enough for Michigan, it should have been good enough for those of us.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jill Zamek with Mothers for Peace. I have a question and a comment. My comment pertains to the push for more nuclear power as a solution to our planet's greenhouse gas situation, and perhaps it's not coming from the NRC, but it's definitely coming. I believe that the promotion of this concept is dishonorable, for it completely disregards the gravity of the predicament with the byproduct of nuclear power, which is highly toxic, high-level radioactive waste, and low-level, too. Here's my question. I want to say it also ignores the amount of greenhouse gas-emitting energy that is required in certain stages of the nuclear chain. So here's my question. Just exactly how much greenhouse gas-emitting energy is required for one nuclear facility? And I'm referring to the uranium enrichment process, the energy needed to manufacture the components of the plant, both original and replacement components, and the energy required for decommissioning. And I suspect you may not have those answers right here at your fingertips, but I would like that information.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. You're right. We don't have the answer, but we will work our level best to get it to you.
My name is Joyce Palaya. I live in Avila Valley. There was an article in the New York Times on Sunday about CAS gaining favor as a method for storing nuclear waste, and the Energy Department falters in its effort to bury nuclear waste at Yucca Mountain in Nevada. The nuclear industry and Congress are taking steps toward a radically different storage strategy, putting the waste in huge casks that could be parked in a handful of high-security lots around the country for decades. And I'd like your comments. You must know about it.
I'm not aware of all of the specific alternative proposals. There are many folks who do have alternative ideas. And for example, there is a private entity that is seeking to get a license for high-level waste storage in an ISPC-type installation in the state of Utah. So that's one. And there are other ideas, and there have been many other ideas proposed over the years, including burial at sea, space, a number of things, reprocessing. So there are a number of alternative and competing ideas, but the federal government has decided on Yucca Mountain or to pursue Yucca Mountain, and that's all I can offer.
That's not what this says. A panel of judges at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission recommended on May 24th that a private utility consortium be allowed to open a lot to store 4,000 casks of waste on an Indian reservation west of Salt Lake City. On the same day, the House voted to order the Energy Department to establish similar storage areas, providing $10 million for the project. And then at the very end of the article, it says, the Department of Energy recognizes that the only way to mitigate its damages, the fact that we have no place to store this stuff, is to find some place to put this material to get it off the utility's hands so that they can get out of these lawsuits. And that's what I'm asking questions about.
So I'm not sure I understand the question. The example you cited in the article is the example I just told you about. It's the place in Utah, and that's, yes. So that's what the NRC panel was looking at.
It's not Yucca Mountain.
I know it's another facility being proposed by an Indian tribe in Utah. Yes.
Thank you.
But I'm sorry, but we will get with you to understand further the question and comment. We really will.
I can provide a little bit more input on that. It's a consortium of utilities called Private Fuel Storage, and they're working with the Goshute Indians to develop a facility there on tribal properties. And the facility is licensed right now by the NRC, or going through the licensing process, will have the ability to be able to store up to 2,000 storage units.
We have another question.
Actually, I have a comment. I wasn't going to say anything tonight. I'm Jerry Lenthal, your 3rd District County Supervisor. I've also been called a watchdog for local residents, my previous life in law enforcement. I think it's important for not only the people here, but the people that are watching this. As a new county supervisor, I appreciate this open communication by NRC staff Art Howell and William Jones. Their emails, timely updates, have provided me many opportunities for answers to my questions, comments, to which I've taken advantage of on several occasions. I also want to thank Diablo Canyon Manager David Oakley and his staff for keeping county government in the loop and informed and quickly getting answers to all of our questions and concerns. I'm confident through this continual dialogue, we will be able to successfully resolve many of the challenges that are ahead of us. I also applaud you for having these meetings and encourage you to keep it up, because this is the best thing we've had in several years. Thank you.
Thank you, Supervisor Lenthal.
Vince, I think we have time for one more individual.
I was trying to get to you earlier, but you deferred to Mr. Wiseman.
Thank you for having these hearings. My name is Russell Hoffman. I drove 280 miles to be here, and I'm sorry to take any of your time at all. I have a couple of books. I brought about 25 books, and one of them here is called The Anti-Nuclear Handbook. It was published in 1978. Is there anyone who knows this book? Just, can you raise your hand? Molly, one person. Well, it has a picture of an attack on a nuclear power plant by a jet airplane. So you can't say 9/11 was a surprise. People knew that could happen. But on 9/11, you didn't shut the plants down. It was 8 hours before you guys did anything. This is a book called Nuclear Power Plants as Weapons for the Enemy, an Unrecognized Military Peril by Bennett Ramberg, written in 1980. How many of you have heard of this book at PG&E? Anybody? No. This one I wrote myself last month because the NRC hearing for my local power plant, San Onofre, managed to go by without, even though I've attended 5, 6, 7 of those hearings in the past decade, there was no notification that I saw. They said that there was an ad in the local paper. We don't get emails or anything like that, and I missed it. So I was upset. So I wrote this book. And anybody in the room who has not got a copy, please feel free to ask it. There's no charge or anything like that. I don't care if you're an employee. By the way, you employees ought to know that by law, Diablo Canyon must provide you with jobs if they shut down. Check that out for yourself. Now, I do have a couple of questions, just a few. The fans that blow backwards, were they installed with the reactor that was installed backwards? It sounds like they were, that they were a constant problem from day one. This performance matrix that somebody else commented on, I don't see anywhere in it where the size of the effect of the mistake is codified or quantified. So you could have a meltdown from one mistake, or, you know, a guy misses a day of work because somebody else sneezed on him. It's a different mistake, but in your matrix, I don't see how they have different levels.
Excuse me, I want to give them the opportunity to respond.
Well,
with regard to the issue you're referring to on the containment fan coolers, the issue there dealt with reverse airflow while the containment fan cooler was shut down, not in service. and you're concerned with if you were to start that fan in a reverse rotation, whether or not you could actually end up tripping off the breakers, in other words, a high current draw when that fan cooler starts.
Okay, my question was only as to how long the problem had existed. As to terrorism, there's, what, 103 nuclear power plants? 102 of them are being counted on your green, blue, red, yellow, whatever list, and one of them, Davis Bessie, too many problems to put on your list. But we've seen an awful lot of indications that Al-Qaeda had nuclear power plant plans in their caves, and they've been told that they're planning to attack, and we've been told left and right. So it seems pretty clear that the reasonable estimate for when for whether or not there's going to be a terrorist attack on any nuclear power plant in America is 100%. It's going to happen. It's only a question of whether or not you can stop it when it does. And what really saddens me here, and I wanted to make sure to mention, this is the last thing I'll talk about, is about a year ago, I heard one of you PG&E people say that you feel that your plant is safer than my plant, San Onofre, because we are in so much more populated an area that we're more likely to get hit than your plant is. Now, that's not a very good assurance, because that's really getting into the head of terrorists, and I don't believe any of you really can do that. And it's also not a very good assurance, because if I was a terrorist, I wouldn't want to attack the plant that's surrounded by Camp Pendleton. I'd want to come up here and attack one that's not so well covered, that you're not expecting to be attacked. I mean, come on, they're going to outsmart you. They outsmarted us on 9/11. And your fire truck doesn't spray inert gases on top of those. So if those spent fuel pools or the dry storage casks do catch fire, you don't have anything that can put them out. It would cost you too much to make that plant safe. And that's all we're talking about is money. It just isn't affordable. And so it was so windy driving up here. There's wind everywhere. I hate to think of how many megawatts were being wasted. Thank you.
Okay. That's the time we have now.
Before you do that, I'm not speaking for PG&E. I don't know of any comparative statements that they made. And going back to your previous point, the possibility of a terrorist attack on a nuclear power plant cannot be dismissed or neglected or assumed not to happen. In fact, quite the contrary, and that's why so many people have worked at state, local, federal governments, the industry, since 9/11 to put in place the measures that have been put in place, and they continue that work.
Also, with respect to plant problems, we do have a graduated process that determines the significance of each problem. We call it the significance determination process, and from that we develop whether or not it's green, white, yellow, or red, each one being of increasing significance. And based on the significance of the problems and number of them at plants, that's what puts us into our action matrix to determine what actions we take at the plant. So we do actually do review the relative significance of the findings at the plants.
But I'll just point out that, Mr. Hoffman, you make an excellent point. If I understood you correctly, a problem that happens under slightly different circumstances, or if it's of a different duration, the nature of the problem lasts longer, then the significance could definitely be different. And therefore, it could result in moving to the right, as we say, in that matrix. And so a problem that involves a human error, for example, on a piece of safety-related equipment under one circumstance could be green, and under another circumstance, a very similar problem could be yellow, could be red. And that has happened. It has happened. It hasn't happened at Diablo Canyon, but it has happened at other facilities.
One other comment that I would like to make concerning that, Art was talking about the individual ones, the individual significant determination. Some of the other aspects that we've discussed this evening has to do with the cross-cutting aspects of things that would not necessarily be considered significant. And what we've done is we started looking at particular trends of very small aspects of things that have not been corrected. So we are also taking a look at the types of trends that are going through Diablo Canyon as an organizational level, and we are also taking a look at that as an overall picture. So we do look at the individual significance of events or mistakes that might happen. We're also looking at overall trends to take into account that type of aspect.
I want to thank everyone for attending tonight. As we indicated earlier, if there are any questions or comments that you didn't have a chance or you think of later and you'd like for us to address, please feel free to contact any one of the NRC members, Mr. Victor Drix, at the number that's provided in the slides, or to provide the feedback form with comments. In addition, as we talked about earlier, if you'd like to get a copy of the Protecting the Nation, or if you just prefer to get it off the web, I would encourage you to take a look at that document. It is very informative. It does talk about ISPC and the reviews, some of the reviews that have been ongoing. And with that, I'd like to conclude the meeting and again thank everyone for attending.
Before you do that, I do want to say I do appreciate everybody coming out tonight. I do appreciate the comments and questions. I feel like we haven't done a particularly good job in a couple of cases in either understanding the question or trying to take notes and get it down. And so I'm hoping that a couple of folks might stay around so that we can get some clarification right after the meeting. Thank you.